Respect. It's more than a word. It's an underlying principle of success and humanity. In the U.S. Army, respect is one of our foundation values. It's the reason we can overcome every obstacle and defeat every foe. So if you're interested in joining a team where respect is earned every day, consider joining our team. And now, in addition to earning respect, you may qualify to earn up to $40,000 in bonuses. To find out more, go to goarmy.com/bonus or call 1-800-USA-ARMY. Paid for by the U.S. Army.
Blog Talk Radio.
After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to be. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to the Revolutionary Radio Project. With your host, Rob Skiba.
All I'm offering is the truth.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody, and welcome to Virtual House Church, week number 38 on the Revolutionary Radio Project. If this is the first time you are tuning in to the Virtual House Church, let me just quickly explain what it is. It's meant to work just like a regular house church. We've talked about in the last probably 3 weeks now about the Nicolaitan model of Revelation chapter 2 and what Jesus had to say about that. He actually said he hates it. And so I don't know about you, but I don't want to do things that Jesus hates. I want to kind of get off of the page that he hates and get on the page that he loves. So with that in mind, if you are confused by what I'm saying regarding the Nicolaitan church model, you can go to virtualhousechurch.com and click on either numbers week 35, week 36, or week 37. Week 37, the one we did last week, is the one I went into the most detail about it. But in a nutshell, basically, the Nicolaitan model that Jesus said he hates in Revelation chapter 2, specifically in verse 13, verse 6. He says, "But this thou hast, that thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate." Essentially, Nicolaitans were those who rule over or lord over the masses, i.e. one guy talking over everybody else, nobody else has a voice in the matter, and also the practice of antinomianism. Antinomianism, what in the world is that? Well, antinomianism is essentially saying that we have grace, so we have no need of the law. And I maintain that we have need of both. I would say that law without grace is tyranny, and grace without law is anarchy. We need a balance of both. Now, I firmly believe that we are saved by grace through faith. It is not of works, lest any man should boast. I firmly believe that, and I have never taught that we need to keep the law for our salvation. But once we are saved, and his law is supposed to be written, or his instructions or his Torah are supposed to be written on our heart, it should compel us to do, the things like the Ten Commandments, one of which is keeping the Sabbath, which begins at sunset on Friday, which is why we are starting now at about 8:30 p.m. as the sun is going down outside my window right now here in Texas on Central Standard Time. So essentially, what we're trying to do is get on God's page again. The Old Testament is just as valid and important as the New Testament. The New Testament is just as valid and as important as the Old Testament. It's one full testament, one big story. And it's not meant to be one guy lording over everybody else. Yes, this is my radio show. I am hosting it. However, I want to hear from you, which means you got to call in to me so that we can interact with one another. That would mean you need to write this number down, 619-789-6815. 619-789-6815, and I'm going to put that link in the chat room here for you. 619-789-6815. And the way it works in a normal house church setting, at least the one that we go to, is we all read the same scriptures together, and then we comment on them. And you'll have insights that I don't have, and somebody else will have insights that neither one of us will have, and I might have a few insights that none of you guys will have. And together we can reason together from the scriptures and hopefully learn a lot. I mean, you can't really do that in a normal church setting when the one guy's up there in the front and he's doing all the talking, and you can't, like, just raise your hand and say, oh, Pastor, I got a question about that, or I'm not sure that's what that's really saying right there. What if it's saying this? Or, you know, have you ever thought about it this way? You'll be politely escorted out of the auditorium if you try something like that. So my wife and I have been doing a regular house church setting on Saturday afternoons for about 3 years now, and I have learned more in the last 3 years than in my entire life put together. I'm 44 years old now. I got saved when I was 7, grew up in the church. My dad was a pastor when I was a kid. Been in church my entire life. And it was one of those deals where I went to Wednesday night service, Sunday morning Sunday school, Sunday morning service, and Sunday night service. So that's saying something. I was in church all the time growing up, constantly in church, and doing the one-year Bible plans, reading through the Bible in a year, and all that stuff. To say that I've learned more in the last 3 years than in all those years combined, that's saying something. And I'm not kidding about it. So my hope is that through these virtual house churches, I mean, a lot of people heard me talking about it on my radio show and in other settings, and they kind of got bummed out. They're like, man, it sounds really cool what you guys are doing, but we don't have anywhere to go. We don't have anybody that we can have that kind of Bible study with, you know, no place to have a house church. So we thought, well, I've got this radio show. Why don't I just take advantage of the subscription? I've been paying $40 a month. Might as well use it and do it on Friday nights. And at sunset. So we've basically opened up a virtual house church for the purpose of doing the same thing that we do in a regular house church. But now I say that, but I don't want you to become dependent on the virtual house church. I want you to come here. I love it when you come here. I want to hear from you. However, I don't want you to become dependent on me. You guys need to forsake not the assembly of the brethren getting together. You need to get with people, live people that you can sit in front of and do this with. And so maybe you can use this as a model. You can see how we do things here and maybe model yours after what we're doing here just to get started. You can use all the resources that we've made available here on the Virtual House Church. I've made an effort to put notes down based on the discussion that we have, as well as commentaries from people like Ardell from YourLivingWaters.com that I read every week. It's pretty simple. If you've been here before, you know how easy it is. And if you don't like reading yourself, then go to Bible.is. It's a great resource online, Bible.is, and pick the translation that you like, pick the type of audio that you like. They have some that's just a guy reading, some a guy reading with music, sometimes with multiple voices doing different characters and sound effects. I personally like that version. I like using the New Revised Standard Version that's dramatized with multiple voices and music and all that. And so if you don't like reading or if you're embarrassed to read or whatever, hit the play button. There's no excuse, okay? Everybody can do this. And so what we're going to do tonight is do just that. I'm going to hit the play button, and we're going to listen to the Torah portions, and then we're going to discuss some scriptures from the what's called the Half Torah, or in other words, the portion from the Old Testament, the prophets, typically, that goes along with the Torah portion reading. And typically we don't get to it because our discussion goes pretty long and we run out of time, but sometimes we are able to get to the New Testament readings as well. But whether we get to it or not, I would encourage you to get to it. I'm going to put a link in the show notes here for you for Virtual House Church Week 38, so you can see what scriptures we're going to be going over tonight. It's called Pinchas or Phineas. Here we go. Boom, in the chat room. There we go. So we're going to be covering Numbers chapter 25, verse 9 through chapter 30, verse 1. And in the prophets, 1 Kings 18, verse 46 through 19, verse 21. And Jeremiah 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3 in the prophets section. And in the New Testament, Matthew 26, verses 1 through 30. And Mark chapter 11, 27. Verse 27 through chapter 12, verse 37, and chapter 14, verses 1 through 26. And I'm actually going to follow the lead of Kevin, who is the leader of our normal house church that we met last week. We're a week behind here in the Virtual House Church, and one of the reasons for that is I take notes when I go through the study, and that gives me something to talk about tonight, so I'm actually prepared for it tonight. So we are actually 1 week behind the traditional readings that most people would be doing around the world right now who are doing the annual Torah study. So if you want to get on the right schedule, you can listen to what we do here on Friday night, and then on Saturday, you can, if you go to virtualhousechurch.com, look in the left-hand menu, you'll see, after you see the various weekly Bible study links, you'll see a picture that says Torah Cycle 2012 through 2013. You can click on that, and it'll give you the readings for every week. So you can do Virtual House Church on Friday, and then on Saturday, if you wanted to get with real people, you could do the same one everybody else is doing all around the world. So you can do it that way if you'd like. Last week, when we were doing this study in our normal house church setting, Kevin decided that we should look at the prophets first. And so let's go ahead and do that. I'm going to actually put the link here if you want to follow along with me. I did not. You're going to have to listen to me read. I didn't get this recorded. I put the wrong link there. Here's the one for, this is the prophet section for 1 Kings. And I'm not going to read King Jimmy because all of these and thous and duths and all that stuff, I have enough trouble speaking normal English. I'm not even going to try to attempt 1600s English because I'll be getting my tang all tangled up while I'm trying to talk here. So I'm going to go ahead and read from an easier to read translation, that being the New Living Translation, because I have a parallel Bible that allows me to look at King Jimmy on the left and New Living on the right. And I'm going to put that in the show in the chat room as well for you if you'd like to follow along with me. 1 Kings chapter 18, beginning in verse 46, says, "Then the Lord," whenever it says capital L-O-R-D, that's where the English translators replaced the name of God over 6,000 times in the Bible, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which I believe is pronounced Jehovah. Some say Jehovah, some say Yahuwah, some say Yahweh. Whatever the case may be, it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I'm going to use the word Jehovah in place of Lord anytime I see it there. So, "Then Jehovah gave special strength to Elijah. He tucked his cloak into his belt and ran ahead of Ahab's chariot all the way to the entrance of Jezreel." Chapter 19. When Ahab got home, this is right after the whole showdown of the prophets of Baal, and where Elijah had the showdown on the mountaintop there, and God's fire consumed the altar and everything, and that whole, this is right after that story. Okay, so chapter 19. "When Ahab got home, he told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, including the way he had killed all the prophets of Baal. So Jezebel sent this message to Elijah: 'May the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you, just as you killed them.' Elijah was afraid and fled for his life. He went to Beersheba, a town in Judah, and he left his servant there. Then he went on alone into the wilderness, traveling all day. He sat down under a solitary broom tree and prayed that he might die. 'I have had enough, Jehovah,' he said. 'Take my life, for I am no better than my ancestors who have already died.'" Now, man, how can I relate to this guy right here? I mean, he's just had this amazing victory. I mean, this incredible showdown where he's even mocking that these guys are doing everything. They're cutting themselves, they're singing, they're dancing. They're doing everything they can to try to get Baal to do something with their sacrifice. And Elijah's mocking him. He's like, "Yeah, maybe your God's out sleeping or whatever." You know, he's totally jacking with him. And then he calls down fire from heaven. He kills everybody. And then, you know, this woman, Jezebel, gets worried about what happens and says she's going to kill him. And he's like, "Woe is me. I just want to die. God, take me out of here." You know, wow. But, you know, there's some powerful principles at work here for us to understand. And I think some of you may be able to relate to this as well. I mean, I can't tell you how much I relate to this. You know, I'm sorry to say, sometimes I get out there and, you know, I'm just totally in the battle. I'm swinging my sword in every direction and loving every minute of it. And the next day I'm just like, "God, just take me out of here. I'm done. I'm so done." Especially with this shaking thing that's getting worse, by the way. So, guys, please keep me in your prayers. Like, my fingers don't want to work very well anymore, and it's driving me crazy, and it gets real bad at night and in the morning, and it's usually at night after whatever I've done all day that, you know, it's acting up, and I'm just like, God, you know, just get it over with, you know. If this is the path that I'm going down, that I'm going to be not able to use my body anymore, just get it over with, you know. So, yeah, I have my moments of depression. I have my moments of doubt, and, you know, I'm not suicidal, but there are times when I just want to get out of here, when, you know, I'm tired. And so I can really relate to what's going on with Elijah here, and maybe you can too. So he fled for his life. He went to Beersheba. He says, take my life, for I am no better than my ancestors who have already died. Verse 5. Then he lay down and slept under the broom tree. But as he was sleeping, an angel touched him and told him, get up and eat. He looked around, and there was beside his head, there was some bread baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. That's important. And I'm notoriously guilty of this as well, because I am a workaholic. Give me a task to do, and I'm just like the Energizer Bunny. Go, 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 go. But even the Energizer batteries eventually run out. And thankfully, I have an amazing, awesome, beautiful, godly wife who cooks healthy food for me and brings it in for me. But when she's not here, when she goes out and does things because she has things to do as well, sometimes I just don't get up, and I forget to eat. And you know what? When you don't eat, your serotonin levels go all wacky, and that's when the devil can really get at you. Physically and mentally, emotionally, you are not as emotionally sound on an empty stomach as you are on a full stomach. So there's a valid point there. He's telling him to rest. This angel tells Elijah that he needs proper sleep, which, again, I'm notorious for not getting enough of, at least not in the proper hours. They say you're supposed to go to bed before midnight, and for every hour before midnight that you are asleep, it's supposedly equivalent to 4 hours of rest, whatever. You've heard me say it before. I'm a night person. I typically don't go to bed before 2, 3, 4 in the morning sometimes. I'm trying. I'm not very successfully, but I am trying to get to bed at least by 11 o'clock and try to get to sleep. But, you know, most of the time I just lay there till 2 or 3 in the morning and, like, thinking I wish I could go to sleep. But there's a valid principle here. Sleeping and eating properly will help you get back in the right frame of mind. So he lays back down after he ate. Then the angel of Jehovah came again in verse 7 and touched him and said, okay, get up and eat some more, or the journey ahead will be too much for him. So he makes him get up and eat some more. And then in verse 8, so he got up and ate and drank, and the food gave him enough strength to travel 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Sinai. Can you believe that? That must have been one heck of a meal for him to eat that much, and it gave him enough strength to travel for 40 days and 40 nights. But this tells me something, because it says he basically didn't eat anything else. We don't have any indication that he did, that he was a 40-day faster. And what's really interesting about that, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's only three Bible characters who were 40-day fasters, and that is Moses, Elijah, and Yeshua. And what I find very interesting about that is, and in one case, it may be speculation, but I think it might be reasonable speculation, they all ended up at Mount Sinai. Of course, we know Moses, Mount Sinai, and the giving of the Torah in the first place, and everything we're reading came from Mount Sinai. But it says after this little showdown with the Baal, that Elijah, you know, had to eat and sleep, get up and travel 40 days and go into the wilderness, where he went to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. There he came to a cave where he spent the night. Now, and somebody else can check this out too. Well, Elijah's name means my God is Jehovah. That's pretty cool. He went to Mount Sinai, but first he was at Mount Carmel, where he had a showdown with the prophets of Baal. Then he went from there to Jezreel, and then he went from Jezreel to Beersheba, and then he went on a 40-day fast and headed out to the wilderness, where he went to Mount Sinai. Well, if you look at where Yeshua was, it says that he went from Galilee down to the Jordan River, where he was baptized, right? And heaven opened up, and God said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased, and the dove came down upon him. And then what did he do? He went out to the wilderness for how many days? 40 days. Is it coincidence that maybe it's a 40-day walk from roughly the center of Israel to Mount Sinai? I think it's a reasonable assumption to believe that the wilderness that where Yeshua went was to Mount Sinai during the time that he was out in the wilderness. And you can look this up. Look up Matthew chapter 3, verse 13 through chapter 4, verse 11. Read that. You'll notice during the temptation that the devil basically gave him a quick ride back to Jerusalem. He didn't have to walk 40 days back. There's no indication that he walked 40 days back from the wilderness. He just went 40 days up to the wilderness. But then you see in Matthew chapter 4, verse 5, that the devil transports him to Jerusalem. You know, he has a little discussion with him there. So it sounds like he got a free ride back. And you see in Matthew chapter 4, verse 8 also, that the devil took him to a high mountain. And I wonder, just wonder, it's pure speculation on my part, but again, I like looking for parallels where I see the scriptures using the same lingo in multiple places. If you compare Matthew 4, 8 to Matthew 17, 1, where this is after the little discussion in Caesarea Philippi at the base of Mount Hermon, that it says in Matthew chapter 17, verse 1, that Yeshua took Peter, James, and John to the top of a high mountain. Well, many scholars believe, as I do as well, that they were already at the base of Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is by far the tallest mountain in the region, that I believe that the Mountain of Transfiguration was on Mount Hermon. And so what I find interesting about that is you got the three 40-day fasters who had all been to Mount Sinai there having a little meeting. Because when he's on what I do believe is Mount Hermon, he's standing there where Moses wrote all about the Genesis 6 experiment, you know, where the angels came down in the days of Jared. They landed probably on the very spot where they were standing, I believe. And God gave Moses this revelation at Mount Sinai, you know, and the whole 40 days, Moses went on several 40-day fasts. And Elijah goes out after having a showdown with the Baals, who are that false god traces directly back to Nimrod, who in Genesis 10, verses 8 and 9, it says that he began to become a Geborim, translated in the Septuagint as giant. He became essentially an offspring genetically of the Nephilim of Genesis chapter 6. So there's way too many cool connections here for me to just brush it off. I don't have it all together yet. I'm still trying to search this out, but I just find it interesting that if you follow the path that Elijah took from Mount Carmel to Jezreel to Beersheba out into the wilderness, 40 days to Mount Sinai, you look at where Jesus went, Galilee to the Jordan, 40 days out to the wilderness. It doesn't say that Jesus went to Mount Sinai, but it's pure speculation on my part, but based on the numbers, it appears that he did. And Paul also, by the way, if you look at Galatians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, we know elsewhere in Galatians that Paul says that Mount Sinai is in Arabia. It's not in the Sinai Peninsula where Constantine's mother put it. It's in Saudi Arabia, according to Paul. And Paul said, look, I didn't go to Jerusalem. I didn't learn from the apostles. I went directly out to Arabia. Well, based on the context of what Paul talks about in Arabia, it appears that Paul, the guy everybody thinks is against the Torah, went to the place where the Torah was delivered. For Galatians, the big chapter where everybody's like, who has bewitched you, foolish Galatians? Ah, you should have nothing to do with the Torah. Ah. Well, Paul did. He went to the place that it was delivered. Crazy stuff. Cool stuff. Anyway. Okay, I digress. But, you know, I find it interesting that the three 40-day fasters, they all apparently went to Mount Sinai, and they were all together at the Mountain of Transfiguration. There's got to be something there. Don't quite have it all together, all the pieces together yet, but following an interesting path, and maybe that'll set you guys on the same path. And if you find something cool, let me know, because there's always more to learn. Laugh all, where did the munchkin came in? Sorry. Yeah, the munchkins came in, yes! That's the voice I'm going to use for anti-Torah people. They're Oompa Loompas, who always freak me out, by the way. Anyway, okay. let's see, where did I pick up? 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 8b. But Jehovah said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Verse 10, Elijah replied, I have zealously served Jehovah Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, and killed every one of your prophets. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. Go out and stand before me on the mountain, Jehovah told him. And as Elijah stood there, Jehovah passed by, and a mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were torn loose, but Jehovah was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but Jehovah was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but Yehovah was not in the fire. And after the fire, there was the sound of a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And a voice said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied again, "I have zealously served Yehovah God Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down their altars, and killed every one of your prophets. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too." Then Yehovah told him, "Go back the same way you came, and travel to the wilderness of Damascus." Interesting. Where was Paul's conversion? On the road to Damascus. When you arrive there, anoint Hazael to be king of Aram, and anoint Jehu, grandson of Nimshi, to be king of Israel, and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from the town of Abel-Meholah, to replace you as my prophet. Anyone who escapes from Hazael will be killed by Jehu, and those who escape Jehu will be killed by Elisha. Yet I will preserve 7,000 others in Israel who have never bowed down to Baal or kissed him. The call of Elisha, verse 19. So Elijah went and found Elisha, son of Shaphat, plowing a field. There were 12 teams of oxen in the field. 12 teams of oxen. Interesting. And Elisha was plowing with the 12th team. Elisha went over to him and threw his cloak across his shoulders and then walked away. Elijah just walked over him, tossed his cloak on him, and walked away. Elisha left the oxen standing there, ran after Elijah, and said to him, "First let me go and kiss my father and mother goodbye, and then I'll go with you." Elijah replied, "Go on back, but think about what I have done to you." So Elisha returned to his oxen and slaughtered them. He used the wood from the plow to build a fire to roast their flesh. He passed around the meat to the townspeople, and they all ate. Then he went with Elijah as his assistant. That's pretty hardcore. He's out there doing his thing, making a living, whatever. Elijah comes over there, throws his cloak on him, and he's like, "Oh, let me kiss my mom and dad." Kills all of his livelihood, basically his what he was doing for work. Kills his oxen, has a big bonfire, and has a big picnic for everybody. And then he gets ready to go with Elijah. Pretty cool. Let me see if I had any more notes here. I was giving you my notes as I was going along, but some of the things that we discussed last week there, I don't have anything else. And I didn't look at Jeremiah last week, so I'll go ahead and look at it this week, and then we'll go on to the Torah portion. Jeremiah chapter 1. These are the words of Jeremiah, son of Hilkiah, one of the priests from the town of Anathoth in the land of Benjamin. Where's Paul from? He is of the tribe of who? Benjamin. Yehovah first gave messages to Jeremiah during the 13th year of the reign of Josiah, son of Amon, king of Judah. Yehovah's messages continued throughout the reign of King Jehoiakim, Josiah's son, until the 11th year of the reign of King Zedekiah, another of Josiah's sons. In August of that 11th year, the people of Jerusalem were taken away as captives. Yehovah gave me this message. "I knew you before I formed you in your mother's womb. Before you were born, I set you apart and appointed you as my prophet to the nations." How cool is that? I mean, that's a scripture a lot of people use there, Jeremiah 1:5. You know, "I knew you before you were formed in your mother's womb." But he set him apart. I mean, that means he made him holy. To set somebody apart, to be set apart, sanctified, is to be made holy. "And appointed you as a prophet to the nations before the dude was even born." Wow. "O sovereign Yehovah," I said, "I can't speak for you. I'm too young." Yehovah replied, "Don't say I'm too young, for you must go wherever I send you and say whatever I tell you. And don't be afraid of the people, for I will be with you and will protect you. I, Yehovah, have spoken." Then Yehovah reached out and touched my mouth and said, "Look, I have put my words in your mouth. Today I appoint you to stand up against nations and kingdoms." This kid, he's just a kid. "Some you must uproot and tear down, destroy and overthrow. Others you must build up and plant." Then Yehovah said to me, "Look, Jeremiah, what do you see?" And I replied, "I see a branch from an almond tree." And Yehovah said, "That's right, and it means that I am watching. and I will certainly carry out all my plans. Then Jehovah spoke to me again and asked, what do you see now? And I replied, I see a pot of boiling water spilling from the north. Yes, Jehovah said, for terror from the north will boil out on the people of this land. Listen, I am calling the armies of the kingdoms of the north to come to Jerusalem. I, Jehovah, have spoken. They will set their thrones at the gates of the city. They will attack its walls and all the other towns of Judah. I will pronounce judgment on my people for all their evil, for deserting me and burning incense to other gods. Yes, they worship idols made with their own hands. Get up and prepare for action. Go out and tell them everything I tell you to say. Do not be afraid of them, or I will make you look foolish in front of them. For see, today I have made you strong, like a fortified city that cannot be captured, like an iron pillar or a bronze wall. I will stand against the whole land, the kings, officials, priests, and people of Judah. They will fight you, but they will fail, for I am with you, and I will take care of you. I, Jehovah, have spoken. In Jehovah, chapter 2, gave me another message. He said, go and shout this message to Jerusalem. This is what Jehovah says. I remember how eager you were to please me as a young bride long ago. Ooh, what? A young bride? How many brides are there? I used to think, before I understood that it's one big testament, it's not old and new, and now that we have the new, we don't need the old, that God had a bride, the Father had a bride, and that Jesus had a bride, and that we as believers are the bride of Christ, and so we're his bride, and then when this tribulation thing comes, boom, we're going to get zapped out of here, church is out of here after Revelation chapter 4, woo, there's no message of the church anywhere after Revelation chapter 4, so see, that's the rapture. I used to believe that, actually, and preach it zealously. And so we're out of here, and then God's going to beat the snot out of his bride and remarry Israel. I mean, how truly sick is that? Now, I'm just bold enough to say it the way it is. Your typical dispensationalist pre-trib guy will never put it the way I just put it, but that's essentially what he believes. He believes the church is going to get zapped out, we're going to go hang out with Jesus, have a little wedding ceremony, then God, the abusive husband, is literally going to smack his bride around for 7 years until she repents and comes back to him. That's basically what everybody believes. That is truly sick and completely anti-Semitic. And just put yourself in the Jew's position. When you hear your typical pre-trib ministry saying, yeah, you know, and after the rapture, Israel's going to come back, finally come back to the God of their fathers, you know, during this time of terrible tribulation. We need to pray for Israel. We need to pray for the peace of Israel. We need to send money to Israel. We need to... That's... You put yourself in the Jews' position. What they're hearing is some guy saying, we're going to get out of here, but you know what, man, we're all for you, man. Here's some money. You know, hopefully this will take care of you. Maybe you can get some food and water while God's beating you up. And maybe you'll turn back to your husband, and we'll be watching from heaven. Okay, have a nice day. Bye-bye. That's essentially what they believe. No, there's only one bride. It is Israel. It is and always was Israel. Israel got married on Mount Sinai. The bride, the church, you know, we say the body of Christ, we say the bride of Christ, we say the church, as they're all synonymous. Well, that's true, but they are synonymous with the congregation, the assembly, the ecclesia, that is the church that Stephen talked about in chapter 7 that was in the wilderness. The church was not birthed in Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 7 tells you the church was birthed at Mount Sinai after the Exodus. And we see in Romans 11 that Paul, the dude that went to Mount Sinai to get tutored by God himself, realized the great mystery. Whoa! This is incredible. You know, God divorced his bride, right? We see later in Jeremiah, he divorced them. But by his own decree, if the bride who's been divorced goes and marries another man, she can never come back to her previous husband. So how did God get his bride back? Well, he came in the flesh. We believe that Jesus is one with God, right? You know, he's the Son, but he proceeded from the Father. He's everything the Father is. He's the expressed image of the Father in Hebrews. Came and redeemed his bride. And the only way that God could do that without violating his own Torah that we're going to read about in Deuteronomy later, I think it's chapter 26, if I remember right. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's correct. The only way the bride is free to remarry is if the husband dies. That's why he had to come and die. to redeem his bride. Paul, in Romans 11, says that if you are a believer in Christ, that you have been grafted into the cultivated olive tree. What is the cultivated olive tree? It's Israel. So you have been grafted into Israel. If you were once a former unbelieving Gentile who became a believer, who crossed over from death unto life, crossing over, that's what the word Hebrew means. Hebrew means crossed over, crossing over. So if you have crossed over from death to life by your belief in Yeshua as Jesus as your Lord and Savior, you have become a Hebrew. You have become grafted, according to Paul in Romans chapter 11, into the cultivated olive tree that is Israel. Galatians chapter 3 says that you have been adopted. You have been adopted into what family? Into the family you are now heirs to the blessings of Abraham. What's Abraham's biblical family? The one that's blessed by God and sanctioned and set apart and holy? Israel. Ding, ding, ding. And that's Paul for you. And then John says in the book of Revelation, when you read chapter 21 and the New Jerusalem's coming down, it describes the New Jerusalem, not Greece, not Rome, not America, New Jerusalem, as it's described, as it is said to the angel, tells John, that's the bride of Christ. Wait a minute. If you're a believer in Christ, what do you call yourself? The bride of Christ. What is the bride of Christ? Revelation 21, New Jerusalem. How is the New Jerusalem described? 12 gates, representing what? The 12 tribes, with foundation stones, the 12 apostles who came from the 12 tribes. There's no 13th foundation stone called the church. There's no 13th gate called the church. Guys, we got to get this. We got to understand this, because as soon as you wrap your head around this and realize that if you have believed in Yeshua, a.k.a. Jesus Christ, as your Lord and Savior, you are Israel, which means all of the promises, blessings, and curses that we read about concerning Israel in the entire Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, all of it together, apply to you and me. That's pretty sobering when you read about it. It's not us and them. That's why Paul said there's no longer Jew and Gentile and freeman and, you know, bondservant and male and female. We're all one. We're Israel. We're this entity called the bride. Right? So once you wrap your head around that, you realize, wow, maybe I should start paying attention to the Old Testament, because God said in Isaiah 46:10, he declared the end from the beginning. So if you want to understand Revelation, you got to go back to the beginning, which is what we're doing here on the Virtual House Church in our first yearly reading together in this online format. We're reading all this old stuff, quote-unquote old stuff, because we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11, these things that we're studying happened to them to serve as an example for us, and they were written down to instruct us on whom the ends of the ages have come. If we believe we're in the last days, we are the ones on whom the end of the ages have come, then we have to go back and look at this stuff so that we can figure out what to do and what the last days is going to be like. That's why it's so important to us. I can't stress it enough. And part of the problem of the Nicolaitan model is they tell you to ignore all that stuff. And there are zealous preachers and followers of these preachers that love to post on my Facebook wall and show the rhetoric that they've been taught by saying, what are you studying the Torah for? That's for the Jews. We don't need that stuff. Or what are you studying Revelation for? We're not going to be here for that. It's not important. The devil's done a really good job of messing everybody up with the Nicolaitan model that Yeshua himself said he hates. So that's why we're doing this study. That's why we're looking at Torah, prophets, and New Testament, because it's all tied together. All right, let's finish up Jeremiah here, this reading. In Jeremiah 2, verse 1, I remember how eager you were to please me as a young bride long ago, how you loved me and followed me, even through the barren wilderness. In those days, Israel was holy to Jehovah, the first of his children. All who harmed his people were declared guilty, and disaster fell on them. I, Jehovah, have spoken. Pretty heavy stuff there. All right, so, boy, time's just flying by here. Let me tell you what, let me just go ahead and play Numbers 25. It's 1 minute, because we're picking up sort of where we left off last week, so it's 1 minute, then I'll read some stuff from Ardell. We'll listen to all of the Torah commentary, all of the rest of the Torah readings after that, and then open it up and we can have some lively discussion. So here we go, Numbers 25.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying,
Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the Israelites by manifesting such zeal among them on my behalf that in my jealousy I did not consume the Israelites. Therefore say, I hereby grant him my covenant of peace. It shall be for him and for his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the Israelites.
The name of the slain Israelite man who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Salu, head of an ancestral house belonging to the Simeonites. The name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, who was the head of a clan, an ancestral house in Midian. The Lord said to Moses,
harass the Midianites and defeat them, for they have harassed you by the trickery with which they deceived you in the affair of Peor, and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of a leader of Midian, their sister. She was killed on the day of the plague that resulted from Peor.
All right. See, that was a quick one. All right. Ardell, I'm going to read from his 2008 commentary. I'll put that in the chat room for you. If you remember where we left off last week, okay, Nicolaitans means conqueror of what is the people. Yeah, that's one of its meanings, certainly, to lord over, to conquer the people. But if you read the commentary from last week, you'll see that there's a lot more to it than that. Interesting reading. Okay, so I'm going to, it looks like this entire commentary, he's got, let me see how many pages here. He's got 9 pages, and it looks like all of it focuses on chapter 25 for the most part. Now, remember last week that they, the Israelites had gone in to the Midianites and whatnot, and they were having sex, and they were turning over their desires to the gods of these foreign people, and got God really angry, and God sent a plague. But this one guy, Phinehas, boy, he was that dude was zealous, man. He went right in there and thrust a spear right through these two people as they were having sex. And God was apparently pleased with his zeal, and it actually ended the plague that was going on there. So that's where we're picking the story up here in this week's study. So if you want to read along with me, there's a link in the chat room there from commentary on Pinchas from 2008. At the end of our Torah portion last week, the children of Israel had once more gotten themselves into some trouble. Upon the advice of Balaam, Moabite and Midianite women were successfully enticing the men of Israel. I got to stop right there, because what's interesting is if all you read is the Torah portion, there's no indication whatsoever that Balaam got the Moabite and the Midianite women to do that. We see no indication of it whatsoever. It's not even in the book of Joshua. I thought, you know, Joshua gives so much extra detail, but Joshua doesn't give it to you either. We don't see that Balaam was instrumental in doing that until we get into the end of the New Testament. I think it was in Revelation, if I remember right. In fact, I think it was in that same chapter regarding the Nicolaitans, where it talks about that they were likened unto Balaam. But we see it was either Peter, Jude, or in Revelation, I forget which, that describes part of one of the things that Balaam did was get these women to entice the Israelites. So it's interesting, because I wonder where they, of course, John got the revelation directly from Yeshua himself. I mean, it's the revelation not of John, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. So you know, maybe he filled them in. But my point is, we don't see any evidence that Balaam was involved with this activity from the Torah or even from the book of Joshua. So if anybody has a resource where prior to the New Testament that describes it, I'd be curious to know, because somehow he got that information. Anyway, these women were luring them into Baal worship, and Jehovah was furious. We read how Pinchas, or Phinehas, the son of Aaron, responded to an incident of immorality between a son of Israel and a Midianite woman, blatantly being performed in front of the tabernacle. I didn't really put that together, but that's pretty hardcore. I mean, you think about the tabernacle and what it means, And it's already bad enough that these men are whoring after these other women, and they're enticing them to go after other gods. But apparently these two that got Phineas so upset decided to have sex right out in the open in front of the tabernacle. I mean, like, whoa, that's hardcore. We see in Numbers 25, beginning of verse 6, and indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now when Pinchas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation, Ecclesia, the church, and took a javelin in his hand. I'd like to see somebody do that in church these days. No, actually I wouldn't. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent. So apparently they went into the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. It is significant that this couple were not ordinary citizens from their respective nations. Numbers 25, verse 14, beginning of verse 14, it says, now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, the leader of a father's house among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur. He was head of the people of a father's house in Midian. Zimri was a leader of the tribe of Simeon. His name means my music. Instead of seeking the heavenly harmony of worship and obedience to Jehovah, Zimri was dancing to his own melody. His father's name was Salu, meaning weighed. That reminds me of a verse in Daniel, in chapter 5, verse 27. You have been weighed in the balances and found deficient. Cozbi was the daughter of a leader in Midian. Her name means my life, and her father's name means rock. Yeshua is referred to as a rock. But this rock had a daughter who was a lie. Her name means my lie. Huh. She was a false bride and a harlot. How did this happen to Israel? It was the goal of the Midianites to open the floodgates for intermarriage, assimilation, and eventually, to the most destructive of all, the erasing of all boundaries between the holy and the profane, i.e. the elimination of Torah, i.e. the Nicolaitan model. Israelite men probably succumbed to the beautiful women who invited them to a big barbecue party. We see in Numbers 25, beginning verse 2. They invited the people of Israel to the sacrifices of their gods, the Baals, and the people ate and bowed down to their idols. So Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of Jehovah was aroused against Israel. Jehovah was furious. This was not only idolatry, but Israel is his bride. So this was also adultery. Cozbi probably had a clear conscience. The worship of Baal included temple prostitution. She may have even considered herself a missionary among a foreign people. Temple prostitution was only for the upper classes and the elite. There is even archaeological evidence of this mixing, as artifacts have been found which are inscribed to Jehovah and his Asherah, the goddess of fertility, which you can trace her back to Semiramis. Again, Baal traces to Nimrod, and the Asherah poles, the Ashereth and all that, trace back to Semiramis. It all goes back to the Tower of Babel right there. And again, that's why I maintain that there's nothing new under the sun. What has been will be again. What has been is again. The whole world worships Nimrod as it is. Look on the back of your dollar bill where it says, in God we trust, in capital letters, all in caps. It's conveniently disguising the fact that everything, you know, a symbol, all of the iconography contained in the symbol has to harmonize with itself for the symbol to make any sense at all. The entire back of your dollar bill is a symbol. There's nothing about the symbols on the iconography on the back of your dollar bill that in any way, shape, or form represents the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So when it says, in God we trust, and e pluribus unum, where it says, out of many, one, many gods represented by one individual, Osiris, which is the all-seeing eye on the back of your pyramid there, Horus, it all goes back to Nimrod. Nothing's changed. That's why I say, you know, why does the whole world worship the beast when he finally shows up? Because they already have been for 5,000 years or somewhere thereabouts. Nothing's changed. Nothing new under the sun. And you see that that's who God's constantly at war with and upset about, because his people, i.e. the bride, the ecclesia, the congregation, is constantly doing stuff related to Nimrod and Semiramis, i.e. Christmas and Easter. Christmas associated with all the dying and resurrecting sun gods that all go back to Nimrod worship, including the Baals. And Ishtar is where we get the word Easter from in the first place, where the bare-breasted fertility goddess pops out of the river and, you know, starts killing babies and painting eggs and whatever. We got to stop that stuff. You see, why are all these stories here? Paul told us, right? He told us that in 1 Corinthians. These stories are there for us to serve as instructions for us. Don't do that. Don't be mixing that stuff. Man, it's just every week it gets driven home even more, at least for me. Maybe it is. I'm the only one, but I hope you guys are getting something out of this. Anyway, Cozbi and Zimri purposefully chose the tent of meeting as the location for their sex act. It was to be a public display of outright rebellion. They were leaders, and they were attempting to teach the Israelites how to be freed from the rituals and the holiness that was part of the teaching of Moses. Get it? They're trying to free themselves from the teaching of Moses. Doesn't that sound familiar? The church today doing exactly the same thing, trying to free themselves. We are set free from all that stuff. In an act of zeal and revenge, Pinchas kills the couple. Is Zimri the Simeonite any less of a zealot for his public display of sex in front of the tabernacle? Rabbi Ari Khan connects this incident with Pinchas, tribe of Levi, and Zimri, tribe of Simeon, with a previous event in Genesis. Genesis 49:5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Yeah, that's right, Chad. Wrath of Khan. One of my favorite movies, actually. Do you remember what this is referring to? Simeon and Levi, sons of Jacob, had a sister named Dinah who had ventured out of the camp to visit the daughters of the land in Shechem. And I'm going to just pause here real quick and just give you a really brief one of my belief systems. And I think I covered this actually in some of the Genesis studies, but I believe Shechem is sitting right on top of the two trees of the Garden of Eden. That's my opinion. I believe that the scriptures would seem to indicate that the tree of life is buried under Mount Gerizim, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is buried under Mount Ebal, which are both in the north and south sides of Shechem. Interesting. So, which is also the first plot of land that they actually purchased in the land that became known as the Promised Land. So again, I think Shechem is sitting right on top of the Garden of Eden, at least the part of the Garden of Eden where the trees were anyway. When the son of the prince of the land saw her, he was attracted to her and took her by force. The men of Shechem tried to work out a marriage agreement, but acted as zealots in rage and revenge. Simeon and Levi entered the town and killed all the men. Jacob was angry with his sons and rebuked them for putting their family in a precarious position with the neighboring tribes. This is the brother's response in Genesis 34:1. But they said, should he treat our sister like a harlot? On his deathbed, Jacob expresses how he feels about his son's actions in Genesis 49:7. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them, Simeon and Levi, in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. Jacob curses their anger and prophesies that their descendants, Simeon and Levi, will be divided. He points out that when they are together, their rage becomes fierce and dangerous. The sages teach that the conspiracy against Joseph was also spearheaded by Simeon and Levi. Well, over the years, it can be shown that the descendants of Simeon and Levi take different directions in how they handle their zeal. When the Israelites worship the golden calf, Moses, from Levi, cries out, and it is the Levites who respond. In Exodus 22, beginning verse 26, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, whoever is on Jehovah's side, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together themselves to him. And he said to them, thus says Jehovah Elohim of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp, and let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, consecrate yourselves today to Jehovah, that he may bestow on you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother. Notice the common elements with the Pinchas episode. Idolatry / adultery, the sword, and the blessing for executing their brothers. Once more, this is zeal on the part of Levi. This time, however, it is properly channeled as it is directed by Jehovah and against those who rebelled. Notice that the tribe of Simeon is silent. History speaks of the same thing hundreds of years later, as it was the descendants of Levi, the Maccabees, oh, I didn't know that, very interesting, who led a successful rebellion against the Greek Empire. And I would, again, reiterate something we talked about a couple weeks ago. If you really have to celebrate something on December 25th, celebrate Hanukkah. Go read the story of the Maccabees. Read how the Romans came in there and desecrated the temple, put up a statue of Zeus, offered up a pig, which is a type of abomination of desolation, in the temple of Jehovah on December 25th. But 3 years later, to the day, the Maccabean revolt, they went in there, apparently sons of Levi, I didn't realize that, but that's pretty cool, went in there, kicked the Romans out, tore down the statue of Zeus, and rededicated the temple to the proper way and function of the tabernacle in worshiping Jehovah. So that's why it's called the Feast of Dedication or Rededication, Feast of Lights. In fact, Yeshua himself celebrated that. He was celebrating the turning away of pagan idolatry and the rededication of the people back to the things of Jehovah. So if you've got to do something on December 25th because your family traditions are such that you just can't break away, then rewrite your tradition to do away with everything that has to do with Nimrod. Get that phallic symbol out of your house that has balls and tinsel streaming down it. Get that out and restructure your celebration around rededicating your life to the things of God as found in his instructions, that is the Torah. That would be something you could do on December 25th. It would actually be honoring to God and not be adulterous and idolatrous. It is not as easy to trace the behavior of the descendants of Simeon. We do have some clues, however. The result of the mixing of the Israelites with the daughters of Moab was the death of 24,000 Israelites by the plague. Bamidbar, or Numbers 26, gives us the current census number of Simeonites. Yeah, I noticed that too. I actually took a tally of that. We're going to get to that in a few minutes regarding how many people there were. Ardell breaks it down for us here regarding the census. Numbers 26 gives us current census number of Simeonites, and Numbers 1 gives the census number from the beginning of the Exodus. We see in Numbers 26:14, these are the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. But we saw in Numbers 1 that originally the previous generation of Simeonites, those who were numbered of the tribe of Simeon were 59,300. So 59,300 is the beginning number, and the number we see after the plague is 22,200. So basically we see with the Simeonites there was a decrease of 37,100 people. A lot of them got wiped out. The tribe of Simeon has lost 37,100 people, and it is easy to conclude that perhaps nearly all of the 24,000 who died from the plague were from the tribe of Simeon. And that's according to Rashi. Thus, we could also conclude that Zimri was a powerful leader of the Simeonites and personally responsible for their deaths as he led them in rebellion against Moses and Jehovah. Therefore, we can make the conclusion that after the prophecy of Jacob over his sons, the tribes of Levi and Simeon proceed in opposite directions with their choices on how to handle zeal. So, what made the behavior of Pinchas, the zealot, appropriate and deserving of being blessed? First, who is Pinchas? Pinchas was the son of Eleazar, the grandson of Aaron. According, we see in 1 Chronicles 9:17, these were the gatekeepers belonging to the camp of the Levites. In earlier times, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, was in charge of the gatekeepers, and Jehovah was with him. That's an interesting phrase right there. Pinchas was in a position of authority as chief over the sanctuary guards. He would have been armed, and it would have been his job to act as protector of the holiness of Jehovah. When Pinchas speared the couple, his zealous behavior was channeled in single-minded dedication to the Almighty. In fact, Pinchas is rewarded for his behavior with the same blessing that Abraham, the father of our faith, Romans 4:16, received in Genesis 15:6. We see in Genesis 15:6, and he, Abraham, believed in Jehovah, and he accounted it to him for righteousness. We see in Psalm 106, beginning in verse 28, they, the Israelites, joined themselves also to Baal of Peor and ate sacrifices made to the dead. Thus they provoked him to anger with their deeds, and the plague broke out among them. Then Pinchas stood up and intervened, and the plague was stopped. And that was accounted to him for righteousness to all generations forevermore. And see, you have to realize, I just heard another video. Man, I wish I had a clip to play here. Maybe I'll, I don't know, maybe I won't. Anyway, this certain high-profile pastor that has me in his sights on a fairly regular basis published another video. This was in April, I think 23rd, if I remember right. And the dude loves to quote from my statement of faith, but he conveniently takes stuff out and doesn't read, like, the next sentence. So what you hear from him is totally in only his context and not the context that I wrote it. He says, he quotes me in my statement of faith where I say, you'll notice that nobody in the Bible was told to make a Bible. And by that I meant 66 books crammed together between two covers with the words Holy Bible on it. But he goes out and says, yes, Sceva, yes, he did. And he goes through a whole bunch of scriptures where God, you know, tells some prophet to write something down. Well, duh, dude, like, get a clue and learn how to read and comprehend what you're reading. I'm not saying God didn't tell people to write scripture. Obviously, he did. I'm saying God never told anybody to go assemble all the scripture that people wrote in separate scrolls, put them together in only 66 books, and cram them together between two covers, put a price tag on it, call it the Holy Bible, and sell it in the Christian bookstore. That's what I'm saying. If you would have read, like, the next couple of sentences, you would have had the context of what I'm saying, but no. He's out there promoting that Sceva doesn't believe that the Bible should be here. That's not what I'm saying. What I said in the preceding and following sentences was that, you know what is amazing? That, like, most of the people in the Bible did what they did without a Bible. You know, everybody up until Moses. I mean, look at all of the fathers from Adam through Noah, Shem, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all the way up until Noah. I mean, Moses, all the way up to Moses. None of them had anything. Moses comes down, gets the Torah. He writes the Torah during the time on Mount Sinai and throughout the journey of their Exodus, 40 years in the wilderness. And that was it. That was the Bible that you had. And those were commanded to be kept together. You know, the five books of Moses were all collected together in one big scroll called the Torah. So if you want to say that there was an assembled Bible that God said you're supposed to read all the time and know it, that's it right there. That's not to say that he didn't tell anybody else to write their own little books, which he did. He told lots of people to do it. But you'll see that pretty much all of them are referring back to their Bible, which is the Torah. David wasn't sitting there going, yeah, you know, I hear you gotta write a couple hundred psalms here, you know, and they're going to put most of them in a book. I better, and then when I have my son Solomon, I better tell him, you know, okay, son, you got to write Proverbs, you got to write the Psalm, what's it called? Ecclesiastes, I think she called it Ecclesiastes. Then maybe throw in the Song of Solomon, you know, if you want to get real kinky. Yeah, okay, so make sure you got those down, Solomon, okay? Good, because they're going to make this book, and you got to get those chapters in there. You know, Paul wasn't sitting in prison saying, "Wow, man, you know, they're telling me that they're creating this thing called the New Testament, and I got to write like 2/3 of it." Man, guard, can you give me some parchment and a pen? You know, I know I'm sitting here in all this fecal matter here, and like, you know, you guys are torturing me and stuff. But man, I really got to get busy writing a bunch of chapters for this collection that somebody's going to put together in 1611. 1600 years from now. Can you believe that? Yeah, I know. That's what they tell me. And it's going to be in this weird language called Elizabethan English or something. But man, I got to get busy here. No. These guys were out there doing their thing, having a personal relationship with God, and writing as the Spirit gave them the unction to do so in their own individual little books. My whole point is that God never told anybody to assemble them all up together and put them in the Bible, and most of these guys did what they did by having a relationship with the author, not the book. I love my Bible. Love it. Absolutely love my Bible. I read it every day, all the time. Study from it, quote from it all the time. We're doing a whole show on it tonight, every Friday night. I live in the Bible. Always have. But, like, what if we could live the way these guys lived? And we're, like, having a relationship, not with a book, but with the author of the book that was allowed to, like, actually inspire us to do things. Oh, maybe even write a thing or two. What would that be like? And you see that the guys that were inspired to write were constantly referring back to their Bible, the only collection that I see any evidence of that God said to put together, which is the Torah. And we see David loved it. David's like, man, I love your, you know, we see law, but it's really the word Torah. I love your Torah. I delight in your Torah. It is life. He's always quoting it. Anyway, I'm going on a rampage here. Sorry. I don't like being misquoted. And somebody is bound to take this show and put out snippets and still going to say Rob hates the Bible. And I don't get it, but it's frustrating. Okay. Maybe that's why I'm shaky all the time. There's all kinds of yahoos out there doing that all the time. Anyway, on the other hand, Zimri's zealous behavior had to be stopped. His energy was not dedicated to the Almighty. In fact, he had his own personal agenda. Two tribes, two directions. One moved toward the Father, one moved toward self. One tribe's zeal merited blessing and honor. One tribe disappeared from the radar. In Devarim, Moses gives his final blessings to the tribes. Devarim is Deuteronomy. Levi receives a beautiful blessing. We see in Deuteronomy 33:8. And of Levi, he said, your Thummim and thy Urim are for your pious one. Simeon receives no blessing whatsoever. No mention of his name, only silence. It is so sad. Yet we serve an Elohim of restoration. Let's see if we can find the resurfacing of Simeon. Simeon's inheritance was within the midst of Judah. And it seems that you find them under Judah's wings off and on throughout the Hebrew scriptures. Perhaps you also remember that there was a man named Simeon who was there in the temple in Jerusalem when Mary, and Joseph, went there on the eighth day for Yeshua's circumcision. Moved by the Spirit, it says that Simeon took the baby Yeshua in his arms and praised Yah. That's cool. That's just, wow, I see where he's going with this. That's pretty cool. Luke 2, beginning of verse 29, Adonai, now you are letting your servant depart in peace, according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation. What does Yeshua's name mean? Yah is salvation. That's why I like it so much. Which you have prepared before the face of all peoples, a light to bring revelation to the Gentiles, and the glory of your people Israel. You know what I think is cool about that is probably in the subtext, but you know, I can see him approaching Mary and Joseph and saying, oh, what is your, you know, he obviously saw something. Something caught his attention, like the Holy Spirit said, hey, look, there's the one I was telling you about. And he goes over to him and says, may I ask, what is the child's name? And they would have said, not Jesus, a word that didn't even exist 500 years ago. They said, Yeshua. When he heard that, the word means Yah is salvation. that probably why he was like a double confirming witness when the Holy Spirit said, hey, go look at that one over there. And he went over there and he asked what the child's name was. And they said, Yah is salvation. That he says, for my eyes have seen your salvation. Pretty cool. See, words have meaning. And you miss that when you like use words that have no meaning. Hint, hint. Remember, it was Pinchas of the tribe of Levi who had been given the covenant of peace. Now Simeon, most likely from the tribe of Simeon, praises Yah for allowing him to depart in peace, the peace that was so elusive to the tribe of Simeon. He discovered that peace was to be found in the baby Yeshua. But there's more. Simeon also had some words for Miriam, Mary, in Luke 2, beginning of verse 34. Behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign which will be spoken against. Yes, a sword will pierce through your own soul also, but that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. I imagine that this is one of those times that Miriam meditated on these words. A sword will pierce through your own soul. This could have many levels of meaning. Being a witness of all that Yeshua would endure would pierce the soul of any mother. But what else could the sword of piercing the soul represent? Hebrews puts it like this, in Hebrews chapter 4, beginning in verse 12. For the word of Yah is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit, and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Yes, the sword will pierce the souls of each of us as it is the discerner of our hearts. In our story in Numbers, the sword killed as a result of blatant rebellion and idolatry. But the sword will touch us all, and Simeon knew that. I think the man Simeon in Luke represents the restored tribe of Simeon. The final restoration of the tribe is seen in Revelation as Simeon once again stands side by side with Levi. This is important, too. And Ardell's really picking up on this here, is where you see, wherever you see the 12 tribes listed throughout the Bible, many times they're listed in different orders. And again, you got to go get a little book like the Dictionary of Scripture Proper Names by J.B. Jackson, have it with you. List them out in whatever order you find them, Old Testament or New Testament, and look at the definition. Look at the meaning of their names, string them together in the order that you're reading it, and then read the paragraph. Because when they switch the names around, it switches the sentences around, and you get a different meaning in the paragraph. And sometimes certain tribes are left out for various reasons. They've fallen out of favor or whatever, like the tribe of Dan is not in Revelation. So, you know, naturally, the definition of his name is going to be missing from that lineup. So it's such a beautiful coded language. It's just wild. But it is interesting that, yeah, we see that Simeon sometimes is out of favor, and then he's restored here among the 144,000 in Revelation. We see that he is once again stand side by side with Levi in Revelation 7, beginning of verse 4. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. Of the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Levi, 12,000 were sealed. So they're right there side by side. Their numbers are interesting, too. We'll get to this when I comment on chapter 26. I did a little spreadsheet showing the numbers at the beginning, when they did a census, the beginning of Numbers, chapter 1. At the number when they did the census again in our study, and then as compared to the 12,000 from each of the tribes that we see in Revelation. And there's something there. I don't quite have it figured out yet, but I'm on a trail that's pretty interesting. And I would encourage you to try to check it out yourself. Now let's zero in a bit more on zeal. In Numbers 25, verse 11, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was zealous with my zeal among them so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Zeal is repeated three times in this verse. Check your translation. It may say that Pinchas was jealous for my sake. It is much more literal to translate zealous with my zeal. Pinchas was displaying an attitude of the Almighty. Or attribute, I should say, of the Almighty. Because Pinchas was zealous with his zeal, Jehovah did not consume the children of Israel in his zeal. Strong's Concordance defines zeal in 7065, Strong's number 7065, kauna, meaning one, to envy, be jealous, be envious, be zealous. And this usage in the authorized version, jealous 10 times, envy 9 times, jealous 5 times, envious 4 times, zealous 2 times, very 2 times, zeal 1, semicolon there, 33. Zeal can be shown to be a negative or positive, or positive, depending on motive and loyalties. Let's analyze its usage. Zeal, also translated as jealousy or envy, used from a negative perspective associated with hostility or disruptive passions. Envy for another's property or position in Genesis 37:11, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Genesis 31, now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Appropriate zeal, also expressing love for one's own property, often translated as jealousy. We see in Exodus 25, verse 5, you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, Yehovah, your Elohim, am a jealous Elohim, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And in Joel 2:18, then Yehovah will be zealous for his land and pity his people. The intimate meaning of the word relates to the marriage relationship. Because by marriage, two become one flesh, adultery was a severing of the unified body, a form of murder. Adultery, like murder, was thereby punishable by death. We see in Numbers 5:30, or when the spirit of jealousy comes upon a man and he becomes jealous of his wife, then he shall stand the woman before Yehovah, and the priest shall execute all this law upon her. Yehovah is depicted as Israel's husband. Pinchas displayed the zeal of the faithful lover, Yehovah, by killing a man and his foreign wife. This couple represented the unfaithful bride, consequently stopping the wrath of the Almighty. 2 Corinthians 11:2 says, for I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I have betrothed you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Messiah. Prophetic warnings against spiritual adultery were ignored. Thus the people received justice. Ezekiel 16:38 says, and I will judge you as women who break wedlock or shed blood are judged. I will bring blood upon you in fury and jealousy. The New Covenant scriptures also have verses on zeal. Here is the word defined in Greek. Zelos, Strong's number 2205, meaning, one, excitement of mind, ardor, fervor of spirit, 1a, zeal, ardor in embracing, pursuing, defending, anything, 1a1, zeal in behalf of, for a person or thing, 1a2, the fierceness of indignation, punitive zeal, 1b, an envious and contentious rivalry, jealousy, usage in the authorized version. Zeal, 6, envying, 5, indignation, 2, envy, 1, fervent mind, 1, jealousy, 1, emulation, 1, 17. Like Pinchas, Yeshua also had zeal for his father's house. We see in John 2, beginning in verse 13. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Yeshua went up to Jerusalem, and he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers doing business. When he had made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of merchandise. Then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal, Strong's number 2205, for your house has eaten me up. Zeal must be coupled with knowledge, according to Romans 10, verse 2, for I bear them witness that they have a zeal for Yah, but not according to knowledge. If after knowledge there is not repentance, zeal brings about destruction. We see in Hebrews 10, beginning of verse 26, for if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment in fiery indignation, which will devour the adversaries. Positive zealousness brings about repentance. In Revelation 3:19, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore, be zealous and repent. Pinchas' zeal led to the covenant of peace. Let's take another look at this entire scenario in Numbers 25, beginning of verse 7. Now when Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel. And those who died in the plague were 24,000. Then Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his Elohim, and made atonement for the children of Israel. What is the covenant of peace? We know who the Prince of Peace is in Isaiah 9, beginning in verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty, Elohim, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of Jehovah of hosts will perform this. And we are told who will have peace in Psalms 165, great peace have those who love your Torah, not despise it, not teach against it, not want to do away with it. And nothing causes them to stumble. Psalm 37 says, mark the blameless man and behold the upright, for the future of that man will be peace. We are told to proclaim the good news of peace, and it is about Yeshua. In Isaiah 42, beginning of verse 7, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation, Yeshua, who says to Zion, your Elohim reigns. Acts 10:36, the word which Yah sent to the children of Israel, preaching peace through the Messiah, Yeshua. He is Adonai of all. Still, the words of Yeshua can be confusing. We see in Matthew 10:34, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Did Pinchas' action give us a picture of what Yeshua meant? Pinchas' zeal, in the form of what appears to be violence, is rewarded with the covenant of peace. Jehovah's zeal will also trigger violence, but the end result will be the regathering of the nations that they might live in peace. Zechariah 3, beginning of verse 8. Therefore, wait for me, says Jehovah, until the day I rise up for plunder. My determination is to gather the nations to my assembly of kingdoms, to pour on them my indignation, all my fierce anger. All the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. The regathering of the whole house of Israel and the resulting covenant of peace is laid out for us beautifully in the two-stick prophecy of Ezekiel 37, which I maintain was not fulfilled in 1948. Doesn't fit. Sorry, but just doesn't fit. It is a little long, but friends, this is our future, so take the time to read it and praise the Almighty for his plan. So let's read Ezekiel 37 together, shall we? And see if the Zionists, Jews who call themselves Jews but aren't really Jews, Illuminati, House of Rothschild, actually fits any of this, the decree of the United Nations in 1948. Let's see, shall we? Ezekiel 37, beginning of verse 15. Again, the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, as for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. And then take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions. You see anything in there about the church? You see only one house? Judah? No, I see two. Northern tribes, southern tribes, coming back together again. Then join them one to another for yourself into one stick, and they will become one in your hand. And when the children of your people speak to you, saying, will you not show us what you mean by these? Say to them, thus says Adonai Jehovah, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, which I would say is where we are. If you are not blood related to any of the 12 tribes of Israel, you have been, I believe, grafted into this stick of the cultivated olive tree that is Ephraim, based on the promises and the blessing given by Jacob to Ephraim, that he would become a multitude of nations, a people who were not his people, who became his people through a grafting in and adoption process, which is not replacement theology. So funny, the dispensationalists, they believe that the church has replaced Israel for 2,000 years, and then after we're raptured out, God's going to deal with Israel, and yet they accuse people who talk like I do of believing in replacement theology. I don't get it. It's like the pot calling the kettle black. I mean, hello, you guys are the ones that believe in replacement theology, not me. I believe in grafting and adoption. And if you are a believer in Yeshua and are not blood related to any of the 12 tribes, I believe you are adopted in / grafted in to this family right here, Ephraim, the stick of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions. And I will join them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand. So it's the whole house coming together, all of us that are Israel, including the believers, i.e. the church, the bride of Christ, the ecclesia, the congregation, the assembly, all of us together. That's what we should be looking for when the regathering takes place. Not one tribe led by Zionists who are under the house of Rothschild, who are Luciferians. And the sticks on which you write will be in your hand before their eyes. Then say to them, thus says Adonai Jehovah, surely I will take the children of Israel from among the nations, wherever they have gone, and will gather them from every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land on the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be over them all. And they shall no longer be two nations, nor shall there ever be divided into two kingdoms ever again. Is the land divided or not? Well, the land is totally divided. It's all hacked up. And the whole house is not there. And they weren't gathered. Yeah, there were people who flew from different parts of the world to go there, most of them of the tribe of Judah. But God says he's going to bring all of the whole house together and bring them there. We're all going to be put there by God himself, based on the Leviticus 26, lays out the rules for how you end up there. He doesn't bring an adulterous family there. It's his land. It's not the Rothschild's land. It's not the Jews' land. It's God's land. It's Jehovah's land. And the only way to get there is to do it his way. And that comes with repentance. When you stop worshiping other gods, i.e. get Nimrod, the statue of Nimrod, out from in the front of your Hebrew university. Take the pyramid with the all-seeing eye out of your Supreme Court. Start doing the Torah again and, like, giving the land rest every 7 years and doing, you know, stuff that God says to do in Leviticus 26, which lays out the rules for occupying the land and coming out of exile. That did not happen in 1948. Didn't happen. Verse 23. They shall not defile themselves anymore with their idols. Really? They will, when they go back to the land, they're not going to have, like, Nimrod statues everywhere? Huh. Nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions, but I will deliver them from all their dwelling places in which they have sinned, and will cleanse them. Then they shall be my people, and I will be their Elohim. Marriage terms there. David, my servant, shall be king over them. Is David king over Israel? No. Is Sharon or any of these other guys David? No. Netanyahu, none of these guys. Zionists. David, my servant, shall be king over them. And they shall all have one shepherd. They shall all walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. They shall all walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. That's what's going to happen when the real Israel is gathered by Jehovah, according to the prophecy of Ezekiel 37. Then they shall dwell in the land that I have given Jacob my servant, where their fathers dwell, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever, and my servant David shall be their prince forever. Moreover, I will make a covenant of peace with them. Is there peace in Israel right now? Has there been peace in Israel since 1948?
No, I would say the answer is no.
Okay. And it shall be an everlasting covenant with them. I will establish them and multiply them, and I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. Is God's sanctuary, is Jehovah's sanctuary in Jerusalem?
I would say no.
That's correct. My tabernacle also shall be with them. Indeed, I will be their Elohim, and they shall be my people. Is Israel by and large a secular nation or a nation observant of Jehovah's Torah?
I would say they're a secular nation.
Correct. The nations also will know that I, Jehovah, sanctify Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst forevermore. Peace seems to be a buzzword in the land of Israel today. You hear of land for peace, prisoners for peace, peace deals. What are they after? You see, peace is much more than the absence of war. Peace, or shalom, is a wholeness, completeness, and a fullness. Being totally filled with zeal for Yahweh and serving him through Yeshua, no matter the cost, this is what makes a person whole. We see this concept pictured through the Hebrew letter Vav in the Torah scrolls. Here is Numbers 25:12. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace. The word shalom is written like this, normally, and Ardell's got the Hebrew rendering of it, is Shin Lamed Vav Mem Sofit. However, in the Hebrew Torah scrolls, this is the only time in the scriptures that the Vav in this word is broken, and the letter appears like this. It shows a Vav that's sort of like a kind of like a Yod with a line below it. And it's like, that's where Yeshua says every jot and tittle is important, because there are codes all over, especially the Torah. There are codes everywhere. Letters bigger than other letters, letters cut in half like this one here, specifically for this one place, leaving a letter out, putting a letter in, spaces different. They're all there for very, very specific reasons. That's why I trust the Hebrew scriptures more than the Greek, more than the English, more than the Latin, more than anything would be the Hebrew scriptures. And you know the ones that are authentic because they have multiple copies that verify ancient texts copied meticulously, such that if you made a mistake, you threw the whole thing out and start over again, they would be confirming themselves as being authentic. The numerical value of the Vav is 6. 6 is the biblical number of man who was created on the 6th day. Man will spend 6 millenniums on earth before the return of Messiah. Yeshua, the Son of Man, was broken for us that we might have peace. Interesting. Also, each of us must be broken. This is what brings us to wholeness, shalom. When this is completed, we will be sanctified and he will be in our midst forever. Baruch Hashem. And Ardell concludes with Revelation 21, beginning in verse 1. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from Yah, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of Yah is with men. And he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. Yah himself will be with them and be their Elohim. And that's where Ardell signs off. Shabbat Shalom from Ardell. We've got 27 minutes, so I'm going to make sure to play the rest of Numbers, and then we'll spend the remaining time, an hour plus or so, hearing from you. I've talked for almost 2 hours here, and I want to hear from you. For the rest of it. So go ahead and call in now, get in the queue. You'll have to call in anyway within the next 26 minutes if you want to keep listening, because at the bottom of the hour at 10:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, the live feed will drop off, and the only way to be able to continue listening beyond the bottom of the hour will be by your telephone. So you'll have to call in 619-789-6815. If you want to go ahead and let me know that you want to talk with me about anything that you've heard so far, hit the number 1 on your keypad when you call in. So you'll call that number and then hit 1. It makes a little icon for me to know that you want to chat. And I've got I don't have any more commentaries to read, so we'll go ahead and get right into open discussion as soon as we finish listening to numbers 26, 27, 28, and 29. Here's numbers 26.
Numbers 26. After the plague, the Lord said to Moses and to Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest,
take a census of the whole congregation of the Israelites, from 20 years old and upward by their ancestral houses, everyone in Israel able to go to war.
Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying,
take a census of the people from 20 years old and upward,
as the Lord commanded Moses.
The Israelites who came out of the land of Egypt were Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, the descendants of Reuben,
of Hanok, the clan of the Hanokites, of Palu, the clan of the Paluites, of Hezron, the clan of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the clan of the Carmites.
These are the clans of the Reubenites. The number of those enrolled was 43,730. And the descendants of Palu,
Eliab, the descendants of Eliab, Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram.
These are the same Dathan and Abiram chosen from the congregation who rebelled against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah when they rebelled against the Lord, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up along with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a warning. Notwithstanding, the sons of Korah did not die.
The descendants of Simeon by their clans,
of Nemuel, the clan of the Nemuelites, of Jamin, the clan of the Jaminites, of Jachin, the clan of the Jachinites, of Zerah, the clan of the Zerahites, of Shaul, the clan of the Shaulites.
These are the clans of the Simeonites, 22,200. The children of Gad by their clans,
of Zephon, the clan of the Zephonites, of Haggi, the clan of the Haggites, of Shunai, the clan of the Shunites, of Osni, the clan of the Osnites, of Eri, the clan of the Erites, of Arad, the clan of the Aradites, of Areli, the clan of the Arelites.
These are the clans of the Gadites. The number of those enrolled was 40,500. The sons of Judah, and Onan. And Onan died in the land of Canaan. The descendants of Judah, by their clans, were
of Shelah, the clan of the Shelonites, of Perez, the clan of the Perizzites, of Zerah, the clan of the Zerahites.
The descendants of Perez were
of Hezron, the clan of the Hezronites, of Hamel, the clan of the Hamelites.
These are the clans of Judah. The number of those enrolled was 76,500. The descendants of Issachar, by their clans,
of Tola, the clan of the Tolaites, of Puva, the clan of the Punites, of Jashub, the clan of the Jashubites, of Shimron, the clan of the Shimronites.
These are the clans of Issachar, 64,300 enrolled. The descendants of Zebulun, by their clans,
of Sirid, the clan of the Siridites, of Elon, the clan of the Elonites, of Jaleel, the clan of the Jaleelites.
These are the clans of the Zebulunites. The number of those enrolled was 60,500. The sons of Joseph by their clans,
Manasseh and Ephraim.
The descendants of Manasseh,
of Maker, the clan of the Makerites. And Maker was the father of Gilead. Of Gilead, the clan of the Gileadites.
These are the descendants of Gilead.
Of Iezer, the clan of the Iezerites. Of Helek, the clan of the Helekites. And of Azrael, the clan of the Azraelites. And of Shechem, the clan of the Shechemites. And of Shemida, the clan of the Shemidites. And of Hefer, the clan of the Heferites. Now Zelophehad, son of Hefer, had no sons but daughters. And the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah.
These are the clans of Manasseh. The number of those enrolled was 52,700. These are the descendants of Ephraim, according to their clans.
Of Shuthelah, the clan of the Shuthelahites. Of Beker, the clan of the Bekerites. Of Tahan, the clan of the Tahanites. And these are the descendants of Shuthelah. Of Iran, the clan of the Iranites.
These are the clans of the Ephraimites. The number of those enrolled was 32,500. These are the descendants of Joseph by their clans. The descendants of Benjamin by their clans.
Of Bela, the clan of the Belaites. Of Ashbel, the clan of the Ashbelites. Of Ahiram, the clan of the Ahiramites. Of Shephufim, the clan of the Shufamites. Of Hufim, the clan of the Hufamites. And the sons of Bela were Ard and Naaman. Of Ard, the clan of the Ardites. Of Naaman, the clan of the Naamites.
These are the descendants of Benjamin by their clans. The number of those enrolled was 45,600. These are the descendants of Dan by their clans.
Of Shuham, the clan of the Shuhamites. These are the clans of Dan by their clans.
All the clans of the Shuhamites, 64,400 enrolled. The descendants of Asher by their families.
Of Imnah, the clan of the Imnites. Of Ishvi, the clan of the Ishvites. Of Beriah, the clan of the Beriahites. Of the descendants of Beriah, of Heber, the clan of the Heberites. Of Malchiel, the clan of the Malchielites. And the name of the daughter of Asher was Sarah.
These are the clans of the Asherites. The number of those enrolled was 53,400. The descendants of Naphtali by their clans.
Of Jaziel, the clan of the Jazielites. Of Guni, the clan of the Gunites. Of Jezer, the clan of the Jezerites. Of Shillem, the clan of the Shillemites.
These are the Naphtalites by their clans. The number of those enrolled was 45,400.
This was the number of the Israelites enrolled, 601,730. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying,
To these the land shall be apportioned for inheritance according to the number of names. To a large tribe you shall give a large inheritance, and to a small tribe you shall give a small inheritance. Every tribe shall be given its inheritance according to its enrollment. But the land shall be apportioned by lot, according to the names of their ancestral tribes they shall inherit. Their inheritance shall be apportioned according to lot, between the larger and the smaller.
This is the enrollment of the Levites by their clans.
Of Gershon, the clan of the Gershonites. Of Kohath, the clan of the Kohathites. Of Merari, the clan of the Merarites.
These are the clans of Levi.
The clan of the Libnites. The clan of the Hebronites. The clan of the Mahlites. The clan of the Mushites. The clan of the Korahites.
Now Kohath was the father of Amram. The name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt. And she bore to Amram, Aaron, Moses, and their sister Miriam. To Aaron were born Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. But Nadab and Abihu died when they offered illicit fire before the Lord. The number of those enrolled was 23,000, every male 1 month old and up, for they were not enrolled among the Israelites, because there was no allotment given to them among the Israelites. These were those enrolled by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who enrolled the Israelites in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Among these, there was not one of those enrolled by Moses and Aaron the priest, who had enrolled the Israelites in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said to them,
They shall die in the wilderness.
Not one of them was left except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. Numbers 27. Then the daughters of Zelophehad came forward. Zelophehad was son of Hepher, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, son of Joseph, a member of the Manassite clans. The names of his daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, the leaders, and all the congregation at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and they said,
"Our father died in the wilderness. He was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah, but died for his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be taken away from his clan because he had no son? Give to us a possession among our father's brothers."
Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying,
"The daughters of Zelophehad are right in what they are saying. You shall indeed let them possess an inheritance among their father's brothers, and pass the inheritance of their father on to them. You shall also say to the Israelites, 'If a man dies and has no son, then you shall pass his inheritance on to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest kinsman of his clan, and he shall possess it. It shall be for the Israelites a statute and ordinance, as the Lord commanded Moses.'"
The Lord said to Moses,
"Go up this mountain of the Abarim range and see the land that I have given to the Israelites. When you have seen it, you also shall be gathered to your people as your brother Aaron was, because you rebelled against my word in the wilderness of Zin when the congregation quarreled with me. You did not show my holiness before their eyes at the waters."
These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. Moses spoke to the Lord, saying,
"Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint someone over the congregation who shall go out before them and come in before them, who shall lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep without a shepherd."
So the Lord said to Moses,
"Take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand upon him. Have him stand before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall give him some of your authority, so that all the congregation of the Israelites may obey. But he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the decision of the Urim before the Lord. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the Israelites with him, the whole congregation."
So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and had him stand before Eleazar the priest and the whole congregation. He laid his hands on him and commissioned him as the Lord had directed through Moses. Numbers 28. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying,
"Command the Israelites and say to them, 'My offering, the food for my offerings by fire, my pleasing odor you shall take care to offer to me at its appointed time, and you shall say to them,
This is the offering by fire that you shall offer to the Lord: 2 male lambs a year old without blemish, daily as a regular offering. 1 lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. Also 1/10 of an ephah of choice flour for a grain offering, mixed with 1/4 of a hin of beaten oil. It is a regular burnt offering, ordained at Mount Sinai for a pleasing odor, an offering by fire to the Lord. Its drink offering shall be 1/4 of a hin for each lamb. In the sanctuary you shall pour out a drink offering of strong drink to the Lord. The other lamb you shall offer at twilight, with a grain offering and a drink offering like the one in the morning. You shall offer it as an offering by fire, a pleasing odor to the Lord. On the Sabbath day, 2 male lambs a year old without blemish, and 2/10 of an ephah of choice flour for a grain offering, mixed with oil and its drink offering. This is the burnt offering for every Sabbath, in addition to the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. At the beginnings of your months, you shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord: 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old without blemish, Also, 3/10 of an ephah of choice flour for a grain offering, mixed with oil for each bull. And 2/10 of choice flour for a grain offering, mixed with oil, for the one ram. And 1/10 of choice flour mixed with oil as a grain offering for every lamb. A burnt offering of pleasing odor, an offering by fire to the Lord. Their drink offerings shall be 1/2 hin of wine for a bull, 1/3 of a hin for a ram, and 1/4 of a hin for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of every month throughout the months of the year. And there shall be 1 male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered in addition to the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. On the 14th day of the first month there shall be a Passover offering to the Lord. And on the 15th day of this month is a festival. 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten. On the 1st day there shall be a holy convocation. You shall not work at your occupations. You shall offer an offering by fire, a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs a year old. See that they are without blemish. Their grain offering shall be of choice flour mixed with oil. 3/10 of an ephah shall you offer for a bull, and 2/10 for a ram. 1/10 shall you offer for each of the 7 lambs. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. You shall offer these in addition to the burnt offering of the morning, which belongs to the regular burnt offering. In the same way you shall offer daily, for 7 days, the food of an offering by fire, a pleasing odor to the Lord. It shall be offered in addition to the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. And on the 7th day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not work at your occupations. On the day of the first fruits, when you offer a grain offering of new grain to the Lord at your festival of weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not work at your occupations. You shall offer a burnt offering, a pleasing odor to the Lord. 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old. Their grain offering shall be of choice flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each bull, 2/10 for 1 ram, 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, with 1 male goat to make atonement for you. In addition to the regular burnt offering with its grain offering, you shall offer them and their drink offering. They shall be without blemish.
Numbers 29.
On the 1st day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not work at your occupations. It is a day for you to blow the trumpets, and you shall offer a burnt offering, a pleasing odor to the Lord. 1 young bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old without blemish. Their grain offerings shall be of choice flour mixed with oil. 3/10 of 1 ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the ram, and 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, with 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. These are in addition to the burnt offering of the new moon and its grain offering, and the regular burnt offering and its grain offering, and their drink offerings, according to the ordinance for them, a pleasing odor, an offering by fire to the Lord. On the 10th day of this 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation and deny yourselves. You shall do no work. You shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord, a pleasing odor, 1 young bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old. They shall be without blemish. Their grain offering shall be of choice flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the 1 ram, 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, with 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the sin offering of atonement, and the regular burnt offering, and its grain offering, and their drink offerings.
On the 15th day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not work at your occupations. You shall celebrate a festival to the Lord 7 days. You shall offer a burnt offering, an offering by fire,
a pleasing odor to the Lord, 13 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old. They shall be without blemish. Their grain offering shall be of choice flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each of the 13 bulls, 2/10 for each of the 2 rams, and 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering.
On the second day, 12 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old without blemish, with a grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, and its grain offering, and their drink offerings.
On the third day, 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, and its grain offering and its drink offering.
On the fourth day, 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering.
On the fifth day, 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering.
On the sixth day, 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offerings.
On the seventh day, 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering.
On the eighth day you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall not work at your occupations. You shall offer a burnt offering, an offering by fire, a pleasing odor to the Lord. 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old without blemish, and the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bull, for the ram, and for the lambs, as prescribed in accordance with their number. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, in addition to the regular burnt offering, and its grain offering, and its drink offering.
These you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed festivals, in addition to your votive offerings and your free will offerings, as your burnt offerings, your grain offerings, your drink offerings, and your offerings of well-being.
So Moses told the Israelites everything, just as the Lord had commanded Moses.
On the fifth day of Sukkot, my true love brought to me 9 bulls, 2 rams, sorry, 2 rams. Anyway, all right, I'm going to open up the phone lines. Hey, by the way, you only got 2 minutes left. You want to keep listening. So you need to call 619-789-6815 if you want to keep listening. In 2 minutes, it's going to drop off the live feed, and you won't be able to hear it anymore. If you want to say hello and contribute to the conversation, press the number 1 on your keypad so that will let me know that you would like to talk. I see 3 people with their icons. 4 people. 4 people. Cool. Let's start with number area code 941661. Who do I have here?
Oh, this is Vern from Punta Gorda, Florida.
Vern?
Yes.
Nice to meet you, Vern. How are you?
Nice to meet you. And while we're listening to numbers, it just got me to think about your anniversary on the 7th. So happy 6th anniversary.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
I was just sitting here playing around with numbers, and I was looking at, like, the Bible and the golden ratio and pi and phi, and I don't know if you've done any research on that.
Not a lot, no. I'm certainly aware of it, though. Pretty fascinating stuff. What did you find?
Oh, some very interesting things. Just like with, are you familiar with the Fibonacci sequence?
Sure.
Of yes, and how that occurs, and just everything from
everything.
The
it's everywhere.
It's unbelievable.
So how do you see? Do you think it relates to anything in the Book of Numbers, or what's your conclusion?
Well, I think our God is a numbers God, because everything fits mathematically with a scientific precision, and it's just amazing how the Word and just how it just fits so accurately, just from every, because if He's going to communicate to us, He would communicate to us in a letter. And it's just amazing how, like the name Yeshua means the hand that came to
what would be more, Yahweh?
Yahweh.
I don't know if you. I'm sorry. This is Michelle Vern's wife. How are
Michelle,
you?
How are you? I'm good.
Hey,
how are you?
Good. Yeah, Vern is. He's been a contractor and a trader. You know, like was a day trader for a long time. So a lot of things are numbers for Vern. So although numbers can be kind of boring, I mean, we were listening and there were some things that really struck me as far as you know, how God appointed His Mohadim, His times, so that we would. Forever, we would honor them, and how we stop from working. I think that was something that, you know, just was constantly said. You won't work at your occupation on the first day of this, you know, this feast, and you'll do this and you'll do that. So I think that that, you know, those were the things that rang out to me when we were reading in Numbers, but. I'm going to let somebody else talk, but Vern is into numbers, so everything about numbers kind of
okay,
rings
yeah,
out.
Cool, appreciate,
he figures
I appreciate
all
that
stuff out.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, Vern, that last couple of chapters there gave a whole lot of animals. It listed a whole bunch of them. Did you happen to notice how many bulls there were, by any chance?
How many bulls?
Yeah.
No,
how many bulls?
I didn't see.
Yeah, go back and look at it. Specifically, where he starts talking about the Feast of Tabernacles and how, you know, beginning on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, how many bulls? It starts counting down. 13 bulls down every day. It drops 12, 11, 10, 9, all the way down to 1 on the last day. And so what you see is a countdown of the number of bulls. And if you add it all up, it ends up being 71 bulls. And the reason for that is, and this is one of the reasons the Israelites lamented the destruction of their temple in 70 AD for the world, because they were making atonement for the world. There were 70 nations that came out of the, 70 people groups, I should say, came out of the Tower of Babel. So all the nations of the world basically were attached to the 70 nations. So what you have is them making atonement for each of the nations on the planet, all 70 of them, and also for themselves, 71.
Wow, that's interesting. So, the other thing that's quite interesting is Nimrod is, you know, one of the bull was one of the symbols that was worshipped.
Yeah,
in regards to Nimrod.
And just thinking about that, when you're mentioning the bull and how the enemy and uses numbers as well in the satanic world, like you think of the bottom of the stock market, it was on 369, and it was 666 was the S&P 500. And if you look at the Dow Jones on the, of course, the market didn't open on September 11, 2001 because it was closed, but the day before, it was the Dow Jones was 9605. 9,
6 plus 5 is 11, 9-11. It was closed for 8 days. You fast forward 9 years later to 2010 on the same 9-11, the Dow Jones closes at 96.05. So you see these numbers, and also the S&P 500 on 9-10 because it wasn't open in 9-11-2001. You add up the series of numbers. It was like a 11-9-11927, and it was 9-1-1 backwards. And so you see these numbers. The enemy uses numbers as well, and like 369, the bottom of the market. And it's just, it's amazing how these numbers are used. And so it just got me to think, and I started, you know, like adding numbers up. I was just thinking while I was listening to it, like 6 times 6 times 6 is 216. You take 6 cubed or whatever, you take 144,000, you divide it by 666, and it equals 216.216.216. And it's just, there's a weird thing with numbers. So I'm just laying here in bed and just listening to the numbers, and just my mind started thinking about all of these different things and how to communicate with all of these numbers. So it's just amazing.
Well, I am not a numbers guy. I'm fascinated by it, but like my head starts to hurt after a while when I try to calculate too much of it. But I think a guy like you would love to really do an in-depth study of the Book of Numbers, because everything is intentional. It's not random. Nothing's random here. And you get a ton of numbers right from the beginning of Numbers chapter 1 with the census. And like I said earlier, I did a kind of a spreadsheet that showed in Numbers chapter 1, it gives each of the clans, you know, like Reuben's clan was 43,730 in that first generation that came out with the Exodus. But that generation died off. And of the new generation that was 20 years old or older of fighting, and it makes specific note that these are people who are of the age to go to war, there was 46,500. So there was an increase in Reuben's clan. And then you go through all of them. I mean, they all averaged out losing about 2,000, losing or gaining 2,000 to 3,000 people. I'm not sure what the significance of it is, but when you take it all together and look at Revelation, what Revelation has to say regarding the 12 tribes, they all boil down to 12,000 from each of the tribes. And it would appear that they're in the context of fighting age. And it also says that these are virgin males who had never been defiled by women from each of the 12 tribes. So it seems to be going along the same lines of young men, probably, you know, early 20s. There. So I don't know what the significance is. I do know that there was 601,730 in Numbers chapter 1 of the first generation that came out from the Exodus. After that generation died, the second generation that is given a census here in Numbers 26, numbers 603,550. So that's a difference of 1820. Again, I don't know what the significance is, but I wouldn't be surprised if Fibonacci and all these other things are somehow, some way incorporated in all this stuff. I don't know how it would be, but wouldn't be surprised. So somebody like you, I'd love to see do a study on it and come out with some of this stuff.
Yeah, there's some interesting things that I was watching on YouTube. It's Marty Leeds, 33, and he talks about pi in the English language. And he talks about some hidden codes in there, and it's very interesting about like squaring the cube and other things, and it's just some of the information on there is very, very interesting.
Have you seen
how the English language is a debtor's language, how it's taken from all of the languages of the world. It's pretty much a modern day Babylon language. Babylon. So
totally.
It's amazing how he ciphers it using mathematics.
So, yeah, have you seen the TV series Touch?
No.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
You saw.
No.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very good with the son who everything's numerical
numbers.
And it all goes around. Yeah. Real cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Well, very good. Awesome. We got some other people here. Area code 916225. Who do I have here? 916225.
Oh, this is Cam Thompson. Pam Thompson from Sacramento. Hi.
Hi, Pam. How are you?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
Excellent.
I just wanted to, two things. First, I wanted to add to what you're talking about with the Fibonacci thing, which is an interesting thing I've looked at before, but not in reference to the Bible or anything having to do with the Book of Numbers, but an interesting application for Fibonacci sequence is creation science. And when you look at all of biology, there's so many places where, you know, the ratio of 5/8, you know, the whole Fibonacci proportions are just written all over nature, from DNA to even how human beings, there was a test, you can Google this, but Fibonacci's numbers are representative of how humans perceive beauty, even facial beauty. And they did the study of all the beautiful women in the world, from Indian women to Caucasian to Asian to African American. They just did this, you know, study of what people think are beautiful across all racial lines. And they came up with this template of a woman's face, and they're all almost exactly the same, with these minor variations for, you know, the eyes or the nose or the thickness of the lips or whatever. But these women who are beautiful to the majority of humans just all look exactly the same. And when you put a map over the face in a geometrical formation, most of the numbers line up in a 5/8 proportion. And you can actually download this map and superimpose it over if you have Photoshop or whatnot. But you can Google all this stuff, and then you can put this geometric mask over a photograph of your own face, and they give you instructions of how to photograph your own face, where it has to be at the right tilt. And then you can tell whether, you know, how close to beautiful you really are. And it's pretty interesting that people all over the world see beauty, and it's even in art, you know, how we perceive art. When you look at an artist's canvas, you know, humans are all programmed around the world exactly the same way to appreciate art in any form, you know, with the same proportion. And that's why, you know, they teach you basic composition in art school, you know, it's using Fibonacci's numbers, and we don't even know it.
If God puts so much attention to that kind of detail, do you think that the Book of Numbers has something of value for us?
It must have. It's so interesting that he brought that up, because now I'm just curious and want to find out more. In fact, I was thinking that someone who I was listening to talking about the lucky number 13, it was on Prophecy in the News, something that was on there just this week. Online, and they were talking about the lucky number 13, or how the number 13, you know, is perceived as either unlucky or lucky. And 13 happens to be 5 + 8. And so I'm going to be diving into that this next week.
Very good.
But the other thing I wanted to talk about or ask you about, and I'm sorry because I didn't get to listen to the first part of the show because I had no internet or some problem. But anyways, I was hoping that you guys could help me because I had the most bothersome dream this week, and I was hoping that I could tell it to you quickly and see if you guys could help me out with it, because it's absolutely related to what you talk about. And so is that okay if I get some dream sequence advice?
Sure. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I'm going to go ahead and open up all the phone lines for everybody else that wanted to contribute, and we'll see if anybody has any insights for you. So everybody who's hit the number 1 on your keypad, you are all live right now, and Pam's going to go ahead and share something with us. Go ahead.
Okay, so I had this dream, and it's just been bothering me so much that I just couldn't even sleep last night. But I'm pretty sure I know what most of it means, but it starts out like this. I go to this conference where there's, you know, it's like a conference where you're going to hear a lesson or, you know, some preaching or whatever, but it's like at a big hotel. And I go into the room, and there's 2 big tables set out there, and each table has these big blank posters on it. And everything in the room is empty, and there's just one person in there, and this person happens to be the guy from House MD that plays the doctor oncologist, his friend, okay? So really, I think it was supposed to be Rob Skiba, but instead it was this actor who plays the oncologist's friend, okay? So it's an actor who's a cancer doctor who's giving these messages. So he's trying to give these messages, which are all the teachings that I've learned from you and everybody else on the internet, Chuck Missler and all these great, you know, teachers of the Bible that I've been listening to these last few years. And but I'm distracted and I can't see these great messages, which are being revealed like no one has ever seen them before. And there's all this conference attendees, and they're in this other room behind the banquet or behind the conference, and they won't come in. They're like having this big party out there. And I'm trying to listen, and I'm also trying to get these people to come in to listen, and nobody will. And meanwhile, you know, Dr. Skiba is, you know, pulling up from the first table all of these big posters and showing these amazing images that are just world-shaking Bible lessons that have never been seen before. And then finally, you know, I'm so distracted I can't even pay attention because all these people are in the other room. Plus I'm trying to get my kids to come in and they won't. They're running around the hallways and they won't go into either the party or listen. So then all this time goes by and nobody's listening. And I'm so frustrated. So I go up into this room upstairs where all this party is going on, and I look in this room, and it's like Christmas up there. But it's also, you know, it's like there's all these gold decorations all over the place. And I go up to the fireplace, and because it's looking like it's catching all the Christmas stuff on fire. And all around the fireplace is things like there's a gold obelisk and a Statue of Liberty and all these things that are sort of, you know, these American, you know, Masonic things. And they're supposed to be Christmas, you know. And anyway, so it all catches on fire. And so this whole room is now just ignoring that Christmas is caught on fire and it's going to burn them all up. And so I go back down into the other room and I tell, you know, Dr. Rob, you know, the Christmas is on fire and the party's going to get burned up. And so, and they just are ignoring it. And so anyways, then my kids finally show up and come into the room and we start to pull these people out from this upper room sort of party thing. And, you know, get to the first one to get pulled out. Now it's switched from Christmas to it's a wedding and there's a bride up in there. And so we're having to pull the church out of this room because Christmas is going to catch them all on fire. And that's how the dream ended, with, you know, us trying to pull these up, but, you know, we only got a few people out. And so what I want to know is, because some of that stuff is pretty obvious, I know I figured out what some of the symbolism means, but what I want to know is, like, you know, something, is this some warning about the time for Christmas, or is this just my own fears of, you know, trying to, you know, is this something I need to work on, you know, getting the message to the church?
This is Chad from Indiana.
Hi.
Hi. I've had 14 years, and this kind of goes on to what I was going to talk about anyway, but I've had 14 years of, now I'll get a little preface here, but I've had 14 years of walking alone in this kind of thing, and I wanted to actually speak to Rob about this anyway. In his opening monologue, he always tells us and encourages us, and I agree with him fully. We ought to be teaching these things in our own areas. But there's people like me out there who have walked alone for 14 years. Virtual House Church has become a respite, a place where I can rest and gather with people of like mind and an answer to prayer, because I needed a place where I could go and lay my head and rest with people who understand things the way I do. So I am thankful for people like Rob Skiba. But the Lord has put me in this area of understanding and seeing dreams and understanding them and being able to interpret them. So the Lord told me exactly what it meant as soon as you were talking. He's basically saying that this world has two choices, and he's laying them out before people today, that he is giving the truth and they have a choice to make. That's what the two tables were. They can hear and understand the truth because he's telling it through his people who are hearing him. And there are distractions which are going on, which is the other room that people are wanting to listen to. And then there is the verse that came to mind, is that saving some, even snatching them out of the fire. And this is basically your compassion for wanting others to hear what you are hearing and see what you are seeing. And yet this world is keeping them distracted by it. So that is the simple interpretation of it, is you're seeing truth, you're hearing truth, you're understanding truth. You know that the time is of the essence, and people need to get it quick because everything's getting ready to go up in fire. And if they can't hear it, the bride cannot hear it, they're going to be consumed by it. That's the simple interpretation of the message of what you saw. It's your heart is crying.
That is so much better and simpler, and I can rest in that, because my thinking, I was getting all worked up about this because sometimes I have these just really vivid dreams. It only happens every, year, maybe once a year I'll have these really vivid dreams or even nightmares, and they just bother me so much because they're so real that they stick with me for a couple of days.
I don't think that has as much to do with timing as though that timing could have something to do with it, as much as the times. And that's kind of what I was going to speak about, too, in regards to these numbers issues, things that we're talking about.
Right.
Like, for instance, it didn't talk about it here in Numbers, but talking about our Torah portion this evening, it didn't talk about it here, but Moses died on that. When he was taken away, he was 120 years. Now, 120 comes up, you're talking about numbers tonight, and that was what it was on my heart too, so it seems to be a night for numbers. 120 is a third of 360. It's 33%. So we have, or 33, which is the number of resurrection, okay, because Yeshua was 33 when he was crucified on the cross. But it's 33 in another sense too, in that 120 also can be divided into a third. 40 years in the desert, 80 when Moses, he was 40 when he went in, he was, or 80 when he went in, 40 years in the desert, and then, he died at 120. So, and I've talked about this before, on the, talking about how in the midst of the ark basically was, time was suspended while they were with him, and their clothes did not wear out. I looked at that clothes more closely. Clothes really doesn't talk about clothes. It's talking about clothing. When you talk about resurrection, that you not be found naked, it really can be applied to the body. In other words, the body was not wearing out. It's not just their shoes, their clothes, or whatever. They did not wear out. But yet, Moses died at 120, which is a third of 360, which also can be divided into thirds. Now, that number 120, you want to talk about numbers, 360 can be divided by 5 is equal to 72. 72 times 5 is 360. 72 is a multiple of 144,000. 72 years is also the number of years it takes for the precession to move 1 degree in our universal calendar. I know I'm going through this fast, but we move around our universe 25,920 years. Or every 72 years, 1 degree on a 360-degree circle. Okay, that's a lot of numbers I know to process. But now, it gets even better. We used to operate on what they call the prophetic calendar, which was 360 years. Okay, we now operate 365 days in a year, which is actually should be 5 divided into 360 to make it equal because the Earth expanded. We would have rounded this in the Gregorian calendar by adding a day every fourth year, which we call leap year.
Leap year.
Which goes in, okay, that's how they get around it. The 5 days should actually be divided into 360 to maintain the prophetic year, but you remember in Revelations it says that Satan will seek to change the times, okay? He seeks to change the times to confuse the people of Israel, the true church. Not that he always has to reference the true times where all calculation is lost. Does that make sense? So you have to have a baseline that he always changes the numbers, but his numbers that are changed always have to refer to the baseline because he has to keep track. I know I'm saying a lot, but if you go back and listen to it, you'll understand what I'm saying, I think, if you think about it. you talk about these numbers and the sacrifices. We've talked before in previous virtual house churches and how the Moedim and the days of the months are prophetic in their days and the timings of things. Rob, I know we've talked about this over and over again, and I know you see this, blood moon tetrads and all that. But we got to understand that you're talking about how all these numbers add up and why they all make sense is the Hebrew language is also a number. God is holy and perfect, so everything he says is also in accordance to a number. So it should not surprise us that when things are spoken in word, they also add up in number, because they are numbers and words. So yes, they have a number, and they are telling us things. They're telling us things about times. So when we see these numbers, just as you pointed out, Rob, about the countdown, it really is a count. So when he's speaking about times and the number of bulls to be sacrificed, this and that, if you can understand what those means, he's also telling us prophetically the times. And I know I've sent you that clock, Rob, which you saw and found just as cool and awesome as I did.
Dude, I'm totally going to get one of those clocks.
That is so phenomenal.
Do you remember the URL for that?
No, but I will.
Or something like that?
I would. Yeah, BibleClock.org, actually.
What is it?
Okay, so BibleClock.org. It actually has the hours as they should be laid out according to the scripture and not according to the Babylonian calendar clock as it's been laid out for us. We show 12 noon.
Their clock starts at 6 p.m., or what we would consider 6 p.m., or at the 6 o'clock position. And works its way up. You know, we see how, you know, for instance, Yeshua died at the ninth hour. Well, by our current clock, that's like 3 p.m. or something like that. So this clock actually, it's laid out, the face of it, it looks just like a normal clock, except numbers are arranged to do the biblical accounting. And it's really cool because your eyes look at it, and you don't even need numbers on the face of the clock. If you see the little hand, you know, the 10 o'clock position and the big hand straight up, your eye just says, oh, it's 10 o'clock. But on their clock, it would be different. It's like, you know, 5 o'clock or whatever. So you actually end up seeing two times at the same time. You see the Bible time by the numbers, but your eyes also see what you would normally recognize as like 10 o'clock, for instance.
Right, and this goes into a whole study. So actually 12 would be what on our eyes would see 5. Okay, so that's where the number 12 should be. So you have to understand then, where should the numbers be? Yes, we know it's 360 degrees, and we know that the day is divided up by 12 or 24 for day and night. But where should those numbers be? Where should they be applied? See, this is part of the satanic plan to confuse the people when I can't remember his name, was talking about the time and the numbers, and we know how the adversary uses numbers. This is why he has done it. He's done it to confuse the time so the numbers match up and point to him, whereas there is the true time and it's true laid out. He has to use the basis and the foundation of, and fundamentals of how things are laid out, but he has to provide a different interpretation to point to seem to point to him, okay? I hope that makes sense, but I know I'm going through that quick. But here's the thing. The sacrifices and the number of things that they're done and the way they all point to him, and they're all prophetic in their timing. I'm doing this study. I'm writing like mad. I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but if anybody ever goes back and hears this or whatever or understands it, they'll know what I'm saying. The numbers of the sacrifices, when they occurred, there was one point where he talked about this one is to be done at the morning, this one's to be done at twilight, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What time was Yeshua sacrificed?
Mm-hmm.
Now go back and look at, there was a second sacrifice that was the same sacrifice. He says should be done at twilight. I think if you look at that in the Moedim, not only can you know the day, but you could know it almost exactly what hour we should expecting him to come back. And this is what breaks my heart, is that we are just now seeing this. I think it's coming out now through not just people like me, but there are people all over who are seeing these things because our Father is revealing them. He's opening them up, not because they've been hidden from us, but what did he say in his word? They're hidden from those because of unbelief. It's hidden to those who don't follow him. But there's a number of people who are seeking him so fiercely now. People who are finding shows in virtual housework like Rob Skiba's program that is a blessing and an answer to prayer, Rob. Please hear me. That need to hear this today because it's going to be important very soon for them in the future, because we're not going to have virtual house church for much longer. In my heart, I don't see it. Not because Rob won't do it, but because we're not going to have the ability to access it.
Right.
You know,
I
and
agree.
So this is important for us to understand this now, because there are people who are hearing this who are going to be, like it or not, the leaders in whatever place they find themselves, for a ton of people who have not been hungry until, you know, pardon the language, the crap hits the fan, you know, then there are going to be some who are waking up, and there's going to be people who have listened to Rob Skiba's program who are going to have answers that people are going to need to know the answers to. Then they will ask. They're going to remember that somebody told them, that somebody talked about this. They're going to remember it's you. And they're going to come looking to you for answers. So that's why it's important for Virtual House Church to continue as it is in my heart for these things. But, you know.
I want to thank you for what you just said. I appreciate that more than you know. But I want to bring something up, because you talked about the fact that based on the numbers and everything that he's showing us, that we could know probably pretty close to the hour of his return. Now, immediately, there are going to be those out there who say, but no, wait, no man knows the day or the hour. So I want to bring something out right here for those who were raised as I was to believe that no man knows the day or the hour. I would point people to Matthew 24, beginning of verse 34. Matthew 24:34. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. That be all the signs that Yeshua gave earlier. About the disciples say, hey, what's it going to be like when you come back? He gives a whole bunch of signs. He says, when you see all those things, that generation will not pass away until all these things be fulfilled. Then he says, verse 35, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. In context, what is the day and hour? No man knows the day, but only the Father. In context is verse 35. He says in verse 35, heaven and earth is going to pass away, but my words shall not pass away. But of that day, what day? The day he just referred to, the day heaven and earth passes away. Only Dad knows when the reset button is going to get hit. It has nothing to do with the rapture that we've all been taught. You know, we're not going to know. Nobody's going to know. And even in the parable of the 10 virgins that follows in Matthew 25, he says to the foolish virgins, you don't know what hour he's going to come back. Well, that's why they're foolish. The wise knew when he's coming back. And Paul says that was it 1st or 2nd Thessalonians? I forget which, but he says, I think it's 1st Thessalonians 5. He says, but of signs and of seasons I have no need to tell you. Why? Because they already know it. He says, but you, brethren, are not in darkness, that they should take you like a thief in the night. The only ones that are not going to know the day and the hour, and the only ones that are going to find him coming as a thief in the night, are those who are not watching, not prepared, not waiting, not looking for the signs that we're talking about here.
I also want to point out, and I think this is in Luke 21, he says, after he said these things, is either the disciples or one of the disciples, I can't remember, says, now we understand you clearly. You don't speak in riddles. You're not speaking to us in riddles. Well, the English person sees that, and you say, what? I don't get it. The day, he says, I will come in a day and hour that is not known, is a Hebrew colloquialism. Okay?
That's right.
We say, I'm coming to a fork in the road. We all know you're not going to look for a literal fork in the road. You're looking for the road to split. Okay? The day and hour not known is a Hebrew colloquialism. It's not saying a day you won't know. It's pinpointing a specific day. The time when before the ending of one moon, the waning of a moon, and the beginning of another moon. This is called, in a colloquialism, the day and hour not known. It's a Hebrew colloquialism. So when he says, I come at a day and hour not known, he's using a Hebrew colloquialism that pinpoints a specific day. Not as we have said, as Satan loves to do, saying a day that it can't be known. So look it up. Do your own research.
Yeah, I think, too, we've learned that Rosh Hashanah, when they are going to blow, I mean, you have to wait to see the first sliver of the new, of the, you know, of the moon after the new moon before they can blow the trumpet. So you really didn't know, and it had to be, a, you know, in, from Jerusalem, and so they would have to wait before they could blow the trumpet.
And it had to be confirmed by two witnesses who were at the top of the temple. So, of course, Revelation makes perfect sense. So you had the 72,000 pairs and the two who are the witnesses, right, to do it. So it all makes perfect sense if we understand God's numerology. Now, here's something else about the time. And Daniel says, times, times, and a half a time, right? And it's like, well, how do you, and they say, well, it's 7 years or whatever. I'll speak to this briefly. We move in a 360-degree circle. That's a day around the sun. We also move in a circle around the sun, 360 degrees, which we call a year. The sun also turns in a circle around the universe. It's all 360 degrees. That is why, and this is part of the study I'm doing, if it ever sees the light of day, a book that I'm doing. That's why when it speaks to, in Daniel, he says, times, times, and a half a time, he's talking about 360. What you have to understand is, what time is he referring to? Is he talking about the time it takes for the earth to turn 360 degrees, or is he talking about the time it takes for the earth to turn 360 degrees around the sun? So you have to understand what 360-degree number is being related to. To whoever who's that guy was, I can't remember your name, I'm sorry, was talking about numbers
Vern.
In the past.
It was Vern.
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 That's why when you see these numbers, times, times, and a half a time, or years, years, and a half a years. Well, it's not necessarily years. Year means 360. You have to know into what relation is the scripture speaking to. Is it talking about the 360-degree day? Is it talking about the 360-degree year or the 360-degree universal turn? That's why Daniel just said times, times, and a half a time. A time is 360. So if you can understand that, understand God's prophetic clock, understand God's prophetic calendar, and know in what relation the times is being related to, you can understand his prophetic calendar. I'll shut up.
Now, with that in mind, this Numbers chapter 29, Feast of Tabernacles, it's a 7-day. People want to talk about being legalistic. Okay, let's be legalistic, because this is the feast where God commands you to have fun.
Yeah.
I know it's horrible, but like, you are commanded to have fun. Now, think about this. It's a 7-day camping feast, basically, with an 8th day called the Great Day. Eighth great day. Now, if you think about that in terms of last day's Moedim significance, is it just a coincidence that we have the 70th week of Daniel as a week represented by symbolic 7 days represented as years, 7-year tribulation period, as some would say, and we have this 7-day Feast of Tabernacles, which is a time for, I would say, the wise versions to rejoice, have fun,
exactly.
Be of good
yeah.
cheer. Because they're elsewhere at this time. It's not a rapture, but they are elsewhere in a Goshen-like environment, I would suggest. With the 8th great day, there's another term for the great day, the great and terrible day of the Lord for some, that kicks off the beginning of the new millennium, which would be the millennial reign of Christ. So, you know, I say this is hugely significant, and there's a reason why he says you're supposed to practice these things every year. Most Americans especially don't have any practice at camping. So, you know, when it hits the fan, as you say, and we're going to have to go out, and, you know, this will be a time that will be a time of rejoicing, I believe, but it's going to be a difficult time for some as well, because they haven't practiced. They're not used to it. Start practicing.
Yeah.
Go out with believers.
Can I jump in here on that?
Sure.
Can I jump in here on that? I've been waiting to talk, and you finally got to the part I wanted to talk about. So, this is Eva in Little Rock,
yeah.
Arkansas. I wanted to talk just about what you were saying on, particularly the Feast of Booths going out. I mean, it's exactly what they did. The family went out. They built a little lean-to that they could sleep in. At night, they could look out and see the stars up above them. But here's the cool thing: is that is the only feast that the king would come down, and he would build his tent among all the other tents that were out there.
And then you and he would just walk around to see what kind of a harvest was coming in. And the people could go up to him and talk to him and say, hey, you know, King, I've had this problem. What do you think I should do? And they could just talk to him. And there was a big, you know, when they brought in all the harvest and they had a huge celebration. And so the king is right down. The king is in the field. The king is in the field with them. He's tented with them. And so I was looking at the Feast of Booths and the Day of Atonement, and that is in the Hebrew month of Tishri. And so, and Chad, you'll like this. I did a quick glance. I found this in my that I'd written a long time ago, or I had saved a long time ago, on the Tishri. And this is like taking a stone and hitting it across the top of the water, okay? Like you're, you know, hitting all the way through the generations here. The first Tishri was the first sin of man when Adam and Eve were banished from the garden and sent into death and labor. The next Tishri is a 2001 BCE, and that's when the dove returned to Noah and on the flood so that he knew that he had dry ground. And then the next Tishri is when Abraham was binding Isaac up on the top of the mountain and showing himself as a man of faith before God, which that was also a representation of Jesus, you know, on being his death on the cross when the goat was there for him. And then this next one jumps over into Sheshvan. And Sheshvan is the month that we think that Jesus was most probably born in, which would be our October, right in there, somewhere in the area of time. And then it goes into that is the first one is, can't read that one. Can't read what it says. It goes into the next things that are happening is all the autumn feasts and the celebrations and the time that Rachel was called the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, and then Benjamin's birth was the last Heshvan. So the 12th child that was born that was supposed to be a child of woe that turned into being a child of joy because his father renamed him also is a representation of the Lord, you know, being he was the Joseph, the Benjamin, you know, the last Adam, if you will, that was also put down as a torture, but also as a blessing. But anyway, it's kind of neat that every Tishri hits on. It starts with Adam and Eve, goes through the Noah, goes through Isaac, and then jumps into the next stage of the birth of the Lord's month with this Heshvan.
That's
awesome. Is happening in all these feasts, that we just read. So there's a connection all the way down, and that's why he says we keep doing it every year. They probably talked about that stuff. They probably said, "Hey, this is the month that, this is when Abraham went up with Isaac this month." You know.
Listen to this, Eva. Every 50th year is a jubilee. If you take 72, if you take 72 divided by 50, you get 1.44 even, which is a fractal of 144,000.
Yeah.
I mean,
anyway,
I think
numbers are so important that we could probably go over this book 3 or 4 times and glean it and still not get it all.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And what I thought was really cool is you see that Moses renamed, you talk about naming Joshua to be, it was Hoshea, named him Joshua. And it specifically says it's Joshua, which is the same name our Savior had, exact same name. That's why it confuses me that the translators were fine with leaving it alone here, but when they got to our Savior, they make up a name. But it's the exact same name, Yeshua. Joshua, son of Nun, and Nun is it's spelled with two Nuns. It's Nun, Nun Safit. And that's really interesting because the letter Nun means life, and when it's in the Safit position, it's a superlative. You know, it's like life exemplified, or what we might consider eternal life. So it's Yeshua, who is life, son of eternal life. And he's the one that brings the Israelites into the promised land. And that's why, like I was reading Ezekiel 37 before from Ardell's commentary and saying that didn't happen in 1948. In fact, there are Orthodox Jewish rabbis that acknowledge the fact that what happened in 48 and 67 doesn't fit either, because what they said, well, wait a minute, our scriptures tell us that the Messiah is going to bring us in, just like Joshua brought them in. So, you know, all these things are there for an example for us to be paying attention to.
Right.
And numerically, noon and noon Safit would add up to 750. I don't know what the significance of that is, but that's what it
means. Yeah, and Vern, I wanted to say this too. Get David Flynn, Temple at the Center of Time.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what these numbers are based on. The numbers, what you're talking about, Rob, is how the adversaries manipulated the numbers to point to him, and that's what I'm talking about. That's why 1948 works, the Temple of the Center of Time, if you measure it. Go back and read the book, and you'll understand what I'm saying. You'll remember that the meridian, the time divider, used to be in France. It's called, actually, now, today, the Devil's Line.
Right.
Okay.
Paris
Meridian. What is the other than the Eiffel Tower? I'm not talking about the Eiffel Tower, which happens to be another phallic symbol. But what is the other major identifying feature of Paris?
Eiffel Tower.
The Louvre. The Louvre.
It's the arch. The arch. Arch.
Oh, wow.
Arch. Right?
I get it.
But look at anywhere where it used to be measured from Babylon. Go to Babylon. Look at any picture. The biggest structure there in the old city is an arch, time. It is all connected. This is why we have to understand it. This is why our calendar works. Our calendar works because it's based numerically. But it's based numerically, and it works only because it points to the actual time of where time will be. The times, and I meant to say this 2 weeks ago, the times will be changed again. If you heard it anywhere from anybody, you heard it here first. The times will be changed again. When the adversary shows up, the times will be changed again to line up. The meridian will be in Jerusalem.
Could be. I mean, they've already added the 13th sign to the zodiac, so that shows that change is in motion already.
Yep. That's part of it, too.
Where does it tell you the adversary is sitting today? Where is time measured from right now?
Greenwich. Yeah, England.
That's what adversary's seat is right now.
Or Greenwich, I think. Okay. Well, yeah, I would have no problem believing that.
There's something I wanted to say about women here. You know, we always think that the Old Testament, which I don't like to use that word either, Rob, but where it was talking about the daughters of Jehoshaphat. That part of it said that if there wasn't a man that could, you know, take
right.
that area of land,
yeah.
then could his daughters get it? And God said yes. God told Moses, yes, definitely, do that. Go ahead and have it. Not only did he turn around right there and you know, put women as being equally important with men in the eyes of God, but then later on when Caleb had his land and his daughter of his older years got married, and she came to him and said, you know, Dad, I want one of the wells. And so he gave her two wells, which is worth way more than gold. And so even then, you know, she was able to go up and get what she wanted, get her requirement of what she requested. So women, at least under the eyes of God, I don't see him changing from the beginning. He wasn't the same from the beginning to now. I think he still had just as much love and care for women. Women were not subservient to men to the point of being less than, because mm-hmm. they were equal in giving possessions and getting possessions.
Oh, and clearly.
Maybe, and more
think,
so
and
we get them covered.
I think Yeshua modeled that too. The first missionary of his resurrection was Mary.
Yeah.
You know, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene in the garden.
That's right.
And of course, the men didn't believe it, so they had to go check it out for themselves. He has set it up so that they have a earthly covering in a man and marriage and all that. But
right.
you know, in terms of their ability to serve him, you know, we're all on the same same playing field.
Well, actually, we're even getting, we get a double covering because we have the Kinsman Redeemer. So not only do we have the Kinsman Redeemer and the Lord Jesus Christ as a covering for us, but we also have, in the way that God has it set up, we should have a Kinsman Redeemer covering us within our family. So, and if not there, at least through the churches, because that's what they did in the New Testament when Stephen was being stoned, was that they were taking care of the widows and the orphans and caring for them, covering them. So all of it, you know, God always wants that covering to be over his women and protected and giving them rights. So, you know, all this mess about we've got to earn our rights, no, God took care of it, and more so if we actually could see it clearly.
I'll say this, too. My wife and a lot of women that I know have a much greater sensitivity, I think, to the promptings of the Spirit. And we would be wise to listen to them. I'm talking to myself. Obviously, my wife's listening, so she's like, yeah, you know. I'm sure she's thinking that. But, yeah, they do.
Rob,
I mean, and I recognize
it,
that.
If we were taken out of your rib, then it's just part of man that was taken out and made woman that has that affinity. So that's why the two of them together make a good team.
Well, yeah,
well,
absolutely.
I was made from DNA, not dirt, so.
Well, yeah.
I'm proud of my feminine heritage.
Not a thing. Yeah, well, yeah, there's that, yeah, no doubt.
Well, not to change the subject, but I have another question for you, Rob. Speaking of the book of Genesis and those tales therein. So, you know, I've heard you talk about how you don't think that it, when you're talking about the, you know, book of Genesis chapter 6 and then Nephilim and the second incursion and all of those topics, which I'm sure everybody listening is familiar with since we're here. But, I always, and I've heard you debate this with Doug Camp and a lot of shows that you have on, you believe that they carried, you know, that the wives of Noah's sons perhaps carried the genes of the Nephilim, and that's
right.
How the, you know, Nephilim continued on. But what about this idea? So was not Noah talking and preaching and warning everybody for all the time that he was building the ark that they needed to repent and that they needed to come into the ark with him? And wasn't it 100 years or more? How long did it take him to build the ark? And did he not?
He built the ark in 5 years.
Oh, in 5 years? Okay, well, so I thought it was 100. I don't know why I thought that. But
well, people, he preached for 120 years for people to repent, and one of my contentions is you can't repent of being born a Nephilim. I can't repent
true.
Of being, I was born French and Polish, and I'm kind of a melting pot. I can't repent of my ancestry. It's what it is. The only thing you can repent of
my
is
point
actions
is
that you are doing.
I totally agree, but my point is that he preached and he told and he put the word out that there was a flood coming and that he was building this ark and that, so the word was out there. So wouldn't you think that if all the rest of the people out there that are against him, maybe some of them believe, since Satan is their inspiration, you know, that they might have built their own escape plan and that they might have floated over the seas because they're big and massive and a lot more, you know, tough than we are, and that some of them escaped to South America and maybe someplace like Ohio River Valley.
But it says, the scriptures contradict that. It says everything that was on land and whom was the breath of life was killed. So, you know, everything that other than sea creatures was destroyed. However, I would say, and I'm going to write about this in either the update to my second book or in book 3, because I tried to suggest with the biblical narrative in my second book, but there are a lot of other things you can look at to give you pause to think, because even if we look at the biblical account where Yeshua said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be the coming of the Son of Man, I believe the days are parallel. So we can look at what was going on in Noah's day and see evidence of it in our day, and we can look at our day and apply that to Noah's day. It would both be applicable. If that's true, we have achieved space travel in our time. We've got people that have been up in the International Space Station for, you know, a long time. People go in submarines for extended periods of time. and are on sea-going vessels and stuff like that. So to the submarine idea as well as the space idea, I can see precedents in our day that would suggest that that was possible in Noah's day as well. And there's an awful lot, there's actually more reports in the ancient world of USOs as opposed to UFOs, unidentified submerged objects. You know, even the Pacific Rim movie that's coming out. I mean, the aliens we thought were to come from elsewhere, but they're really here all along and under the ocean. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the scriptures talk about the Raphaim and things that are under the sea being stirred up and whatnot. So, yeah, I do believe that there could have been remnants from the pre-flood world that did, in fact, or could have, in fact, survived in submersibles as well as in spaceships. When you look at the Epic of Gilgamesh, and I talk about this in the Quest for Truth with Doug Hamp, I believe Zechariah chapter 5 and the woman in the basket is talking about Ishtar returning. Ishtar, according to the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think it was tablet 11, if I remember right, took off into space. So, could be. But biblically speaking, just sticking strictly to the narrative immediately following the flood, every single post-flood giant that we read about in the scriptures, specifically the Amorites and Philistines, traced back to the people in Genesis chapter 10 with no mention of angels anywhere. The only way that's possible is for somebody in the ark to have carried it. And if the three sons were offspring of a genetically pure Noah and his wife, then they're no-goes in that regard. The only suspects that are left are the three wives,
yeah,
which are not mentioned until verse 18, which follows verse 12, which says all flesh had become corrupted.
Right. Well, they had to travel from there to Peru and from there to the Ohio River Valley and other places. Like, I'm in Northern California, and there's stories in Nevada where they found giants in Lovelock, Nevada.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
They
the Phoenicians,
were all over. So they were all over.
Absolutely.
And how did they get here? You know, certainly...
Yeah, that's in the post-flood world. The post-flood world, especially during the eradication of the land of Canaan, the Israelites were just slaughtering giants left and right, but they didn't get all of them, and it tells you that. Joshua failed to get a number of them, and then hundreds of years passed until David was able to give it a shot. He didn't get all of them either, because 1 Kings 9 tells you Nephilim built the temple of Solomon, and so they migrated out of the land of Israel as a result, I believe, of the Israelites pushing them out. And, you know, Canaanite altars in the Federal Reserve is the most listened to radio broadcast that I've done here on the Revolutionary Radio Project so far. And we are able to trace Canaanites leaving the land of the Levant to settle in Jekyll Island, where the Federal Reserve was created. So, yeah, I mean, they made it all over the Americas and everywhere.
L.A. Marzilli on the trail of Nephilim, 5 minutes remaining.
Oh, man, 5 minutes
remaining. Hey, Brother Rob.
Four minutes, yes, sir.
Hey, you were talking about Quest for Truth with you and Doug Hamp. I just recently listened to it. By the way, this is Gus
too.
In California. Yeah, that was good
cool.
stuff. I was hoping you're going to bring up Israel maybe next time, because I really like your insights on that. I think you're really on to something.
Yeah, I don't think
Doug would agree with you, though.
Well, maybe not. I mean, I've got to say, I love Doug, first of all. Just love
him.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
He's coming around a lot closer to thinking along the same lines that I've been thinking on a number of these subjects. I mean, we've intentionally held back on some of them because, you know, we got to give the show a little bit of a head start. But, you know, that's why we figured we'd start with Revelation 1 and just work our way forward, because it's going to come up. And I think by the time we get to Revelation 4 and 5, a lot of this stuff is going to have to come out. And we're going to have to talk about the rapture. We're going to have to talk about this land of Israel. We're going to have to address dispensationalism head on. We're still in chapter 1, so, yeah, it should be good.
Hey, Rob, I'm going to
see you. Hey, you guys touched on something. Real quick, you guys touched on something last Quest for Truth. And it was about, you know, the recombinant DNA and stuff like Doug Hamp presents. And I'm thinking, you know, I agree with you how you're saying that this data was carried over by the flood through the wives of the sons of Noah. But could they have also been these fallen angels instead of actually physically creating the Nephilim? Could they have also manipulated the gene pool using,
sure.
That,
we got 1 minute left.
Too?
We got 1 minute left. That's L.A. Marzulli's thesis.
Email, Rob.
Okay. right, L.A. Marzulli, I'm going to have to just mute everybody right here just so I can put the closing on the show. But L.A. Marzulli is tracking down that path right now, and we had an interesting discussion about it in Chicago, actually. He believes that DNA tampering, he's moving off of the angel sex path. He's coming off of it slowly, especially as he's been doing his own research in Peru and whatnot, and realizing there were female Nephilim and that the male Nephilim were not sterile. That's a huge revelation for him. He even told me that. But he's tracking down the idea of genetic manipulation. And I'm like, you know, great, but show me biblical support for that, and I'll be completely on board. So, but that's all the time we have for tonight.
Respect. It's more than a word. It's an underlying principle of success and humanity. In the U.S. Army, respect is one of our foundation values. It's the reason we can overcome every obstacle and defeat every foe. So if you're interested in joining a team where respect is earned every day, consider joining our team. And now, in addition to earning respect, you may qualify to earn up to $40,000 in bonuses. To find out more, go to goarmy.com/bonus or call 1-800-USA-ARMY, paid for by the U.S. Army. Respect. It's more than a word. It's an underlying principle of success and humanity. In the U.S. Army, respect is one of our foundation values. It's the reason we can overcome every obstacle and defeat every foe. So if you're interested in joining a team where respect is earned every day, consider joining our team. And now, in addition to earning respect, you may qualify to earn up to $40,000 in bonuses. To find out more, go to goarmy.com/bonus or call 1-800-USA-ARMY, paid for by the U.S. Army.